Sound. Ladies and gentlemen, take your seats, please. Okay, the second day of the meeting is called to order. The chair notices the presence of a quorum. Miss Rogers is somewhere. You're going to, I'll do it. Eisenberg, present.
Great, present.
Bruce Collins, present.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. A.G. Kawamura, the Secretary of the Food and Agricultural Agency, has just walked in. We're in deep trouble. Everybody pay attention. Welcome, Mr. Secretary. Appreciate you being here. Members, there are a couple things on your desk, some new information, a couple of slides that you might be able to read have been reproduced and enlarged, particularly the DWR water summary, which is the total statewide projected chart that was impossible to read yesterday. It's still complex, but it's all on the back is the water balance 2009, which I think even if you can see it and read it with clarity, understanding it is a major challenge. This is illustrative of how difficult it is to explain complex arrays of issues, and in my opinion, no more so than in the water world. Number two, there's a one-page paper titled Informational Follow-Up Items. Nancy Ulrey, who looks innocent but is sitting in the front row right there, is, apart from all of her other duties, she is now the deputy director in charge of collection of loose ideas and questions, and will remain so for the 2 years we're going to be working. My ideas are loose, yours are concise, focused. But it is the assembly of things that were said yesterday as written down by the staff. And what I'd like to suggest to you is, the last item before we adjourn today ought to be to examine this list, expand and add on it as we see fit, and we'll go ahead and schedule that action for all the future meetings, because it seems to me the follow-up suggestions, comments, and questions from the meeting is something that's really important and also useful to the staff when they talk to the consultants. Then one other thing I was just mentioning to Mr. Nordhoff. If you have a purient interest in water, you can either spend all day, every day, reading websites endlessly, or there are at least two sites I'd like to recommend to you that you think about. Department of Water Resources does a five-day-a-week press clip service. It's primarily directed at press, but it'll get out to some, the big dailies for sure. It'll get a lot of the local news as well. But the other site that's useful, and we'll send you, Joe, maybe you could just send a note on the web addresses, is a site run by the California Water Education Foundation, Rita Sudman's organization, and it's called aquafornia.com. And the reason that's interesting is not just because she has all the news stories, but she's also trying to reach out and get significant blog postings. And it's a, I find it a very useful, I skim both. We'll get you the information on that, and you'll learn the damnedest things. Therefore, it's useful. Okay. all right. Let's see here.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
In the spirit of our all getting up to speed, I have a recommendation based on our experience yesterday. And that is, when we have, when we are discussing a topic that is under the primary jurisdiction of another agency, I think it would be useful for that other agency to participate in some appropriate form in the briefing. So, for example, next time we discuss water rights, I think it would be useful to have the State Water Board participate in some manner in the briefing.
We actually talked about that, and the reason we didn't ask all the agencies with cross-cutting or primary authority on all the issues is we would have had 15 people in the audience and we would have been spending 2 days to discuss it. But as we go through the issues, for example, on water rights, I think Mr. Grindstaff and Mr. Stevens thought that there would be an occasion where you'd want to bring in the Water Board with authority, the Attorney General for legal interpretations, and other parties. And we'll try to stagger out the subjects. The overview, unfortunately, didn't allow that to happen. Joe?
That's exactly accurate. I think it is our intent to bring the agencies in as we really delve into the issues deeply. Yesterday, we weren't planning to spend as much time on water rights as we ended up spending on water rights, so we didn't have the experts here. But certainly we will.
Well, I noticed that we didn't have free time, and of course I understand that time didn't permit that. But I do think, Chairman, that would be a useful approach.
No, I agree with that. Let me add one thing. I've learned on a subject like water rights that you can bring in all the experts you want, but there are always 50 attorneys waiting out there who wish to spend an equal, if not longer, period of time pointing out the misrepresentations made by the governmental agencies entrusted with the responsibilities. Although watching the lawyers fight is pretty enjoyable sometimes. The last thing is members have told me that I am a heartless taskmaster. Therefore, there will be a 10-minute break at 10:30. These meetings, and people will yell at me if it doesn't happen. Please. Okay. All right, Mr. Grindstaff, tell us about
today. Mr. Chairman, may I interrupt for a second?
Pardon? Yes, sir.
I do appreciate the two copies we got, but there were four that I think, had they been legible, would have provided a lot of useful information. Another one is on the page of on page 11 under the PowerPoint presentation, historical and current data, and the other one is the bottom of page 27. I think those would be useful too if we could get larger depictions of them.
And
let's do that.
That's exactly why we want to have this follow-up from the meeting, because it's my fault. I when Pat asked me, okay, what is it we should do? I said, well,
I think all the blame should go to the chairman. I don't think you should take any of that, Chairman.
I'm perfectly happy with that.
And so is Phil.
Well, the other thing you might want to do is to take these slideshows and also email copies to the members, because if you ever want to consult with them, that's probably the fastest way to get high resolution.
And they will all be posted on the web if they're not already posted on.
Yeah, all. If we didn't mention it, all of the communications we get, all of the material that is presented at these meetings without regard to anything else, any written statement by someone that's given to us, all of it is posted on the web within a day or two, I think, of the meetings. And, of course, the broadcasts of these meetings are recorded and posted on the website.
Within a day, typically.
Within a day, so people can watch a recorded version if they were not able to watch during the session. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, then my thanks to staff for preparing the informational follow-up by this morning. I think that's the right speed as well as comprehensive approach to keeping track of what we do. Thanks.
Well, my visualization of what happened is, as we were walking back to the office, they all huddled in the meeting, and they probably said, those guys are nuts. Did you hear what they asked for? What are we supposed to do? I'm sure. Isn't that what you said, Mr. Grindstaff?
It's actually what legal counsel said.
Ah. No response necessary. We understand your...
I thought I warned you not to tell anybody what I said in privileged communications.
Anyway, we have a number of things to go through today. I believe we can get out early, and I want to restate, if we can focus on this, get audience participation as well, we're going to... I want to try to wrap up by noon if we possibly can. No guarantee, but that's our goal. Okay, day two, item number 12, the lead scientist report. Dr. Don? We've slightly rearranged the room. We're still fiddling with this. Improvements to come. Hopefully this is slightly better.
Thank you, Chair Eisenberg. By the way, for the rest of the council members, I would prefer not to be called Dr. Doom or Dr. Dam. Dr. Dom is okay, but I prefer Cliff. I'm sorry, I don't have any PowerPoints today, so I'm not going to test out your new system here, but I do have some information I'd like to share with you. Okay. The first one is a follow-up on a question that was asked to me yesterday, and that has to do with the sea level rise over the past decade from 2000 to 2010. I want to acknowledge Sam Herriter from the science program staff.
Sam, wave your hand.
No. He chased this information down very, very quickly. And basically, the information is that in the 2000 to 2010 period, sea level has risen another 1.2 inches, about 31 millimeters, or a little over 3 centimeters. The good news is that it's continuing to be a fairly linear rate of increase. It has not moved into an exponential phase of increase, which is what is projected in some of the information I provided you yesterday, which comes up with that 55 to 145 centimeter estimate by 2100. If you linearize that this past decade, you'd be at more on the order of something like 31 centimeters or something like that. It is well monitored worldwide, so this information is the kind of information you can get pretty readily. Sea level is being followed throughout the world, and it is an important issue. Places like Bangladesh, for example, a meter of sea level rise wipes out half the country. So these are kind of issues that we can probably find you good scientific information on that. You have a one-page briefing that we put together that just gives you a few things going on in the Delta Science program. I just wanted to highlight a few of them very, very quickly. First one is that I wanted to let you know that we have added to our staff a half-time scientist who has an expertise in hydrodynamic modeling. This is, I think, a very important area of expertise to have. His name is Chris Enright. We'll be sharing him 50-50, but he's one of the leaders in being able to link what's going on with the hydrodynamics of the Delta and the biological and ecological systems within the Delta. And so he has started to work with us half-time, and he's certainly a resource that some of you might want to visit with if you're interested in that interface between ecology and hydrodynamics. Second thing I wanted to highlight is that we're in the process of trying to develop a monitoring and assessment program, a more holistic version of that. We've taken a former lead scientist, Sam Luoma, and he's assembled a group of about a half a dozen scientists. And they are working on trying to put together a good integrated monitoring and assessment program. I think this is important because as we move forward with some of the fairly substantive restoration projects that might be done in the Delta, we need to be able to evaluate the effectiveness of these kinds of efforts. And this is the kind of I think, overview plan of how to do this that will help us make sure that we have a robust monitoring and assessment program moving forward. The third thing I wanted to highlight is the Vernalis Adaptive Management Program was reviewed by the science program here recently.
Explain Vernalis, please.
It is a gauging station on the San Joaquin, on the lower San Joaquin, where information on flows are gathered. And this has been a decade-long experiment to look at whether or not flows have an effect on the migration of salmon through the lower San Joaquin out into the Delta and into the San Francisco Bay. This program has been going on for about a decade. We were asked to review the program. The report will be out shortly and be posted on the website. A couple things I wanted to highlight relative to the review. The last couple years, a new, I think, and highly innovative technology has been employed that actually involves putting small acoustic tags in the juvenile salmon and allows them to be followed in terms of both the routes that they're taking and also how many of them are making it through the Delta. The information for the last 2 years during low flow conditions are that very, very few are making it through the system and that predation is very, very high. Over 90% of the tagged salmon that were put in the system did not make it through the Delta. So this is this report and also some guidance on how to move forward will be out shortly. And we'll share that link with you when we post.
Can I just ask a general question on restoration actions, programs, ideas, plans generally? There's a lot of publicly owned land in and around the Delta. There's a lot of publicly supported projects by various agencies. Can we say with confidence that all of them serve what is now the state purpose, co-equal values, and some sensitivity to the Delta? Or is this just kind of stringing together what a lot of folks want to do on their own for many different purposes, and by adding independent actions up, we claim we have a plan or something? I mean, I've never understood that.
I'll try to answer that by basically pointing out that we actually had a workshop to try to get at that question, because this is a landscape scale issue. And a whole bunch of postage stamp restoration projects within the Delta probably has a much less chance of being successful than having an integrated, larger scale restorations judiciously placed. And so we actually had a workshop, and all the information on that workshop is posted, including all the presentations, where we asked those kind of questions. And we brought in 5 outside experts and coupled them with 10 people who are thinking about restoration in the Delta to try to basically talk about, where do you do restoration, when do you do restoration, how do you basically decide on which on the tidal energy that is going to be changed by doing the restoration. Do you start in Sassoon Marsh, for example, or do you start in the North Delta? Those kinds of questions are important questions that need to be thought through before we invest a large amount of money in the restoration process. The one thing that the panel did say very loud and clear is that we need to get on with it. We've been talking about it for decades. It's about time that we actually started doing it. But a coordinated effort and a decision making on where, how, why, and how to evaluate, I think, is pretty critical.
Mr. Fiorini.
Cliff, I'm wondering, do we have a comprehensive list of all the recently completed restoration projects in the Delta, those currently underway and those about to be launched, the source of funding and the purpose of those?
It will be a mixed bag. We know some of them, and we know that have been done. We know if some of them are planned in the very near term. I think we could work on getting you that. I can't give you a very good answer off the top of my head.
Well, if we don't have a go-to list currently, I think it would be really helpful for the work of this council to have that as we look into the additional scientific programs that we're going to be approving in the near term.
And certainly the BDCP process is also thinking about these kinds of questions about where and what extent and what acreage and basically how to phase these in.
The other thing that might make sense is to ask the Delta Protection Commission for a list of activities on the local level that they consider to meet whatever test we have. Because I know from some experience in Sacramento, there's all kinds of relatively small stuff at the very fringes of the secondary zone that are driven by housing development or shopping center. You know, they're more the mitigation. And I've never been personally convinced that mitigation standing alone automatically contributes to an overall approach and solution. But I don't know that. I understand the utility of saying it does, because that might mean somebody else helps you pay for what you want to get done, but that would be an interesting potential inventory.
There's also some very good restorationists living within the Delta and working within the Delta.
You bet.
We should certainly bring those people in also.
Yeah. Okay.
Are you going to be around when we talk about the interim plan later on today?
I plan to be here for the rest of the meeting.
Okay, because I wanted to talk a little bit about the vamp and predation when we get to that point.
Okay. And then finally, the last briefing item that I wanted to talk about is the Independent Science Board.
Okay. Pay attention. This is something we have to do in short order, appoint an Independent Science Board.
Based on our discussion at the last council meeting, we have gone forward with sending out a solicitation to scientists that have been involved in the CalFed science program. We went to all of the past science board members. We went to people who've been supported by the science program. We went to reviewers that we have used in the past in the science program. We have opened up a nomination process that is to close on April the 30th. As of this morning, we have 39 people who have expressed interest in being on the Independent Science Board. The statute says up to 10. We will be working with you through your chair and any of you on the council who are interested in participating in the process in identifying up to 10 people and trying to bring that group of 10 people to you for presentation and approval at your next meeting.
The statute contains kind of minimal requirements for members of the board. Could you refresh our?
Yeah, some of the requirements are that they be a national or international stature in their fields of science, and that they also not be engaged in research that would be put them in conflict with the review process that they've been asked to do for reviewing science within the Delta. So I think those are the two main criteria. We were looking for a diversity of types of people and types of expertise, and I think we have a pretty good suite to choose from, and I suspect we will get more between now and the 30th.
Cliff, if we were to approach someone, how much time would we say would be required?
To be participant in this process? I've been telling people who have been contacting me that we expect a minimum of 2 meetings per year, maybe 3 or 4, depending on what issues are being brought forth to the council, that the meetings would be in general 2, possibly 3 days long, and that there would be at least equal amount of preparation time to get ready for the meeting. So those are the kind of time guidelines I've been providing.
Is there remuneration attached to this?
There is.
How much?
I believe that we set a... and I think Lauren Hastings here, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe we set $150 per hour, consulting value on their time, plus their expenses to travel and participate in the.
Are we looking at anyone outside the United States?
Yes. I had a chat with Phil about this idea, and we do have a few people who have expressed interest. At least I know one person from Australia has applied, and one person from Canada has applied. The Canadian happens to be quite familiar with the system, and actually the Australian, too.
A lot of international consultants have floated in and around endlessly these various programs.
Floated?
In
Is that
California.
What you said?
No pun intended by that. They've come in and out. They've consulted. They're still consulting. There's a lot of talent around internationally, and Australian talent particularly interested me with their experience in the drought. They might have a lot to tell us. Just an observation. Should we get in an appeal status for BDCP, I suspect the time commitment of the Independent Science Board would be significant on that. You know, the statutes, they are to advise on that, and that may be more lengthy. I understand the problem of attracting international and national level talent with a kind of an abstract commitment of time, but that could be much more time consuming and intense toward the end of 2012.
I think your point's well taken. I think we probably need to be quite open and honest with these people that there is this possibility of a building and accentuating time frame that they might have to put into their efforts.
Okay. All right.
Yes. One more question.
Yes, sir.
Would all of these people be consultants? Would some be full-time university faculty members?
All of the above, yes. In fact, I think the previous Independent Science Board was probably predominantly academic scientists, but it was a mixture.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Okay, any other questions on this?
Yes.
All right.
Cliff, what actions will the council take in this process to appoint the science board?
Well, we will be working, I think, initially with Phil and any of the others of you who would like to be participatory. We will assemble basically a spreadsheet of the people who we are considering, their expertise, some background information on them. We will have CVs for all of these people and references for all of these people, and then it'll be a winnowing process to basically decide on which 10 people we would like to basically go forward and make assurances that they would want to serve and that they're willing to serve under the kinds of conditions that we've been just talking about. And then as soon as possible, we then will seek your approval on these 10 people. In the next few weeks, if any of you want to review CVs or provide input on the list, that's certainly something that we'd be more than happy to provide.
The council would be hopefully expected to act approximately when?
I would hope that we would have 10 names that we've agreed upon to you for your consideration at your next meeting.
One of the things we might want to think about, I think it's plausible that we might find ourselves at the end with 8 names of people that fit the test and 2 skill sets not fully represented by the applicants. I don't know. I'm just making this up, but that's likely in my opinion. And just speaking for myself only, I would not find it amiss to start with a somewhat lower number and announce that we're seeking skill sets in certain subject areas and all of that in it to supplement it. I think it's important, though, to get the science board, independent science board, up working and operating.
Agreed. And one of the other jobs of the independent science board by state statute is to begin the process of the selection of the next lead scientist.
Right. And you'll be responsible for all this, Cliff?
I will be working with you in being responsible.
You are
for
the
this.
Responsible party.
I am.
If something goes wrong, we know who to go to.
That is correct.
Thank you.
So, Cliff or Joe, do you anticipate soliciting public comment on potential appointments before the council acts at our next meeting?
That was not something that I had put on my planning. I'll let Joe maybe address that.
Yeah, I don't think it's I think our intention was to put it on the agenda, and obviously with the names, there will be an opportunity for people to comment on any item on the agenda, including that, both in writing ahead of time, as we will notice it 10 days ahead of time, and also at the meeting.
Hi, Don.
So I think in that way there will be some opportunity.
Thank you. And Cliff, I had a question about your report.
Which report? Oh, the report that was provided, the one pager provided to you?
Yes. So
yes.
If we could go back to that. You described the efforts to coordinate hydrodynamic modeling and also the development of a unified monitoring framework. Do you anticipate that that work will reach a point where it will inform our draft plan by July of 2011?
Yes, I think certainly the development of the Unified Monitoring Framework, that is a timetable that we have requested of them, that they be finished up with their efforts by this fall. Okay. Relative to the hydrodynamic modeling, this is an area of a number of people are actively trying to couple an understanding of the hydrodynamics of the system with the behavior and ecology of the fish populations out there. This will be a long-term ongoing effort. There has been some progress made, for example, in coupling some of the particle tracking models with some of the behavioral aspects of delta smelt to basically look at their distribution at different times of the year and different stages of their life history in the delta. These are the kinds of things that we want to continue to support. In fact, our next agenda item will be suggesting that we invest some more resources in that. I think it will be an iterative improving information base through time, but you're not going to have the answer on coupling hydrodynamic modeling and fish population dynamics in the delta in the time frame that you just asked for.
Thank you.
All right. Let me just see. Anyone in the audience like to talk to us on this issue? Come right forward, please. State your name, organization, if you're representing an organization, firm, business, association, and to this point, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Morning.
Council members, my name is Mark Rentz. I'm Director of Regulatory Affairs at the Association of California Water Agencies. I just wanted to reinforce one of the points that Cliff made earlier about monitoring and coordination of recovery or restoration projects. I think that's absolutely essential and something you should consider early on. And the reason I bring that forward is I had the opportunity and the privilege to serve on SB 271, Salmon Restoration Advisory Committee, for about 5 years. And that was something we did not have available to us from the very beginning. And the result of that was some projects were approved that got state funding, and some of them got subsequently got federal funding, that when we went back and looked at them later, they didn't make any sense in the actual context of the watershed. Let me give you just one very obvious example. We approved habitat restoration on the riparian, adjacent riparian areas in some streams. And when we were later had the opportunity to examine the entire watershed, we could have restored all that habitat and made it Cadillac habitat, but because there was barriers downstream, the salmon couldn't even get to that habitat. So I think it is very critical that you consider that as you deliberate on the restoration projects, and maybe perhaps talk to the Fish and Game Department about that program and how they put it. They had even GIS mapping to identify.
Later on today's agenda, we have Fish and Game coming in to talk about exactly this generic
brilliant minds
area.
Think alike, yeah. I guess. Yeah. Anyways, I just wanted to bring that to your attention. Thank you very much.
All right. Anyone else? Okay. That was not an action item, but an information item. Cliff, if you don't mind, I'd like to give Secretary Kawamura the chance to talk to us briefly and then we'll get right back to you on the next item. For those who have not met the secretary, he is a powerful and influential force in state government, and a farmer from Orange County. Might be the last couple surviving farmers in Orange County, but he is.
There's a good handful.
And a terrific guy, by the way.
Mr. Chairman, members, thanks for an opportunity to just raise a few issues that actually are pertinent to what we just heard, both in the area of climate change and both in the area of restoration and the health of, and the stewardship of the Delta. Yesterday, earlier this week, the Invasive Species Council, the California Invasive Species Council, which was formed earlier this last year, met. It's a council made up of five different agencies here in California. It's our agency, of course, Resources Agency, EPA, Health and Human Services, Homeland Security, with their relationship with Customs and Border Protection. And the role of this council is to really understand the threats that come from invasive species. The Invasive Species Advisory Council, the ISAC, has put together a very comprehensive plan of across all the taxonomies, all the different kinds of invertebrates, insect pests, arthropods, and diseases, viruses, for example, that are really a threat to California. It's an amazingly comprehensive compilation of the pests that we will either expect to see introduced in California or will be are threatening to be introduced. And one of the things that I see that's taking place really in many discussions around not only the state, around the country, and around the world, is the lack of understanding the threats to these systems, the life systems of a state that come from these pests. I was in Japan just a short while ago in Tokyo talking about global food security in the face of some of the challenges from global climate change. The reason the Japanese were hosting the meeting was, along with the United States Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, is that they recognize that there's a clear pathway of hazard, if you would, of how we're going to feed the 9.4 billion people on the planet by the year 2050. And the food systems that have to be in play to do that are under threat from things like rising sea levels, unpredictable weather, and unpredictable weather means unpredictable harvest. The high amount of concern they had, though, was also the threat of movement and the different climate patterns that would then affect what these invasive species can and might do. And the one thing I would like to add to that is we were at, just last week, US EPA had a clean water conference and talking about nutrient loading into water. On that agenda, and I happened to be on the panel there, there was not a single word again about invasive species as a subject area of how an entire watershed can be impacted and changed and biologically altered by not nutrient loading but invasive species. So as you look to your science panel, as you look to your advisors, I just would very, very strongly encourage you to make sure that this becomes a high level of high priority for you to address the challenges for all the great things you can do in terms of restoration, in terms of dealing with nutrient load into the Delta and the different things that impact this Delta. You have to recognize that all that can be for naught if you have the wrong species. I was in that same meeting, the Indiana director of EPA was one of the panelists on us. He was alarmed because there was not a single mention of this flying carp, which is moving up the Mississippi, which is going to alter, again, the ecosystem of that Mississippi River. And these are the kinds of things that I would ask all of you to keep a hard focus on. And then there are wonderful experts around the world, around this nation, around our state, that have a solid background in this. I ask you also, if you will, be free to use that advisory council, the Invasive Species Advisory Council, as you proceed on your mission to deal with the stewardship of the Delta. Thanks, good. Chairman.
Thank you. I'd just like to mention that the secretary puts out, I think annually, your report on agriculture in California, the official title being...
Well, we have an ag vision process that we're working on.
Well, but also annually you do a report.
And there's a directory of the resources directory.
And the resources directory is a very valuable document along with the Department of Finance statistical abstract, our version of the census update. Mm-hmm. Terrific source of information on detailed questions. And for some reason, most people don't want to get any of the facts. They just rather talk abstractly. And I would recommend the Secretary's publication to you for your attention.
and that Invasive Species Council is now has a very good website, and you can access the list of the comprehensive list of invasives for California, and it's an alarming list as well. So thank you very much.
Mr. Secretary, before you go, a question. I thought we had a daunting task up here, but I think you have one even more daunting if you're trying to prevent these alien species from coming in. Do you focus on prevention, detection, measurement, amelioration?
Yeah, the best dollar spent, and we work hand-in-hand with the agricultural commissioners in each county. We work with Fish and Game. We work with our border station infrastructure with USDA and ourselves. The ports of entry are clearly the first step, and exclusion is the best dollars spent, keeping them out in the first place. Second to that, and prevention, educating people not to bring stuff in, and then also in the area of trade, there's a lot of exotic, as you know, exotic pet trade going on, and you can order online virtually anything you want, whether it's a piranha to a spider to a snake.
A flying carp.
Once you have, you get past that thing, the next best step, of course, is early detection. Early detection is the best dollar spent. If you find something well established that shouldn't be here, that's where you end up with enormous dollars, whether it's a pike up in Lake Davis, whether it's Spartina out on the mudflats out in different parts of the that's an aquatic weed. These species, the best thing we can do is start to really ramp up our ability to look for things that we would expect might be introduced. That is your best expense, and then keeping them out in the first place.
Is there still a lot being introduced through shipping, ship bottoms, and ballast
water? Absolutely, all the above.
Is there anything you can do with that?
It's interesting. The National Invasive Species Council is made up of seven different agencies. I failed to mention business, transportation, and housing because Caltrans is a part of this Invasive Species Council. But Department of Defense and Commerce is a part of the National Invasive Species Council. And Commerce has jurisdiction over the ballast loads and all the rest of the international freight that goes on the waterways.
So there's no way you can disinfect a ship's hull before it enters a certain harbor?
They're working on some very difficult ways, or I guess 21st century ways to try and address just that ballast and cleaning them out before they get into our waters. It's a hard challenge.
Of course, yesterday we saw a slideshow from one of our scientists who reported that some illegal and imported species turn out to be very popular. The $100,000 award for catching bass in ponds that are full of exotic weed species that we would like to get rid of. I mean, it's incredible how we adjust good and bad to that kind of stuff. Supervisor.
Yeah, just while the Secretary's here, I wanted to ask maybe Joe and our staff that with the consultants we're going to be bringing on board, what is the interface that's going to be required of the consultant with Secretary Kawamura's not just agency, but I think getting down into some of the working groups like the invasive species group and so forth. What is going to be the responsibility for the consultant, or is that going to yet to be determined? Because I think it's important that you get all these parallel efforts going on and drawing upon that collective expertise and information that will be current, certainly about agriculture, but also about the invasive species. So
I think there are two levels of effort. First of all, as the chair mentioned yesterday, we have a meeting, I think it's next week, with all of the state agencies where we plan to talk some about how we integrate across state government to make sure that everybody's coordinated. The issue of how we reach down in, not only to the Department of Food and Agriculture, but even further down into the counties, is one we have to work out with the consultants. And I think that'll take us a couple more weeks before we can get there.
Okay. Well, in Secretary Kawamura and I myself got a chance to speak at a conference down in Cortland here on the Grow Local, and I think some of the things are being done by I think not only food security but to encourage farming, and certainly he from his own personal background, but I think just his work daily shared a lot, and it was one of those things I think that when you look at the Delta and you look at the food baskets that is the Delta, but certainly the fragility of any number of aspects of the environment down there, it's going to be very important that the Secretary's agency, but his expertise and that of his staff is really called upon as we're putting together a Delta plan, because it's going to be a key piece of what we're going to be considering, I think, in the months ahead. So I appreciate his work and that of his staff, but I think it's going to be key to our considerations before this council. So,
thanks. Okay.
Thank you, Supervisor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Good to see you.
Good to see you all. Sure.
Okay. Cliff, let's go back to the next item, which is number 13, an action item, grants, science grants.
Before we move on to that, may I just
yes, sir.
Say that I strongly concur with the comments that we just heard from the Secretary, and I would like to add one sort of interesting embellishment that I just learned about in a conference I attended down in Corpus Christi, Texas. We had some of the leading restorationists in the United States at that meeting, and one of the more interesting and I think an insightful talks was given by a man, Bob Twilley, who is working both in coastal, in the Gulf Coast, coastal Louisiana and coastal Mississippi, and in the Everglades. And the point that he made was that in both of those systems, they're attempting to do large-scale restoration, as we are trying to do here in California. But because the water that they're using to do this restoration is not of the same quality as it used to be, the direction of restoration is not going the way they often want it to go. So, for example, instead of getting sawgrass in the Everglades, they're getting cattail marshes. And in the very in coastal Louisiana, they're basically have this very nitrate-enriched water from the Mississippi, and they're just simply not getting the kind of coastal marsh that they were hoping to get. So this is an issue. This is an interactive issue with invasive species and nutrient loading, and these things are not singular effects. They are often additive and multiple effects. So I just thought I'd throw that out as something to be thinking about as we think about large-scale restoration and the quality of the water in the Delta.
Okay.
Okay.
Oh, but the Independent Science Board will make sure we don't make those mistakes.
I'm sure that we will have good members on the board that will give us great advice.
Okay. Item 13, sir.
Item 13. This is an action item. We're requesting from the council to be able to go ahead and compete our 2010 focused proposal solicitation package. We briefed the council in the last meeting a little bit on the proposal solicitation package itself. This is a proposal solicitation package to fund approximately $8 million of scientific research funded through Proposition 84. We've been given assurances that the resources are available to move forward with this. We had in 2009 a meeting where we discussed topics, and the topics that were selected and endorsed by a group of stakeholders that participated in this gathering to come up with research areas are four. They're listed in your packet, but I'll just go over them briefly. One is one theme area is native fish biology and ecology. This is in particular related to some of the things that we simply just don't know about the behavior and ecological needs of some of the key fishes in the Delta. Second area is on focusing on food webs and the relationship to water quality and other drivers, and other drivers certainly are non-native species that are in the system and predation that would be within the system. The third area is coupling hydrologic modeling with ecosystem or ecological modeling to try to understand both the water movement and how it affects the biological communities in the system. And then the fourth area is to try to develop decision support systems to help us make decisions on water operations and water supply issues within the Delta. So these are the four areas that we have targeted for this solicitation package. $8 million is envisioned as being awarded. We're asking the council's go ahead and set a deadline and to begin the process then of soliciting proposals, reviewing the proposals, making recommendations to the council on which proposals to fund, and awarding those proposals. And that would probably be over basically the rest of this calendar year.
Okay. Now, if I understand this correctly, these were all the things you had approved going ahead doing in 2009 but got delayed because of budget problems.
This was one effect of the bond freeze was we had to stop this process.
Yeah. Normally, I would probably want to drive you into a more detailed discussion of the methodology and the consultation with parties, but this is one of the assumed duties we have from Bay Delta CalFed that's kind of there, and unless there's a reason to vary anything, my inclination is just to say, yeah, let's go do what we wanted to do last year. I'm sorry, what you wanted to do last year. Mr. Grindstaff.
I want to add to the discussion by Cliff that these items still fit very nicely with the NRC report that just came out what, 6 weeks ago?
Mm-hmm.
And these items help address some of the holes that they identified in that report. So things hadn't changed much in the year between when the science program identified these areas as needing more work and when the National Academy mm-hmm. actually reviewed the Delta and said these areas indeed need to be studied. We need answers.
The NRC report specifically had modeling, fish ecology, and food webs and other stressors, basically, as things to...
Mr. Stevens?
Thanks. I just wanted to add one thing. Cliff talked about the process. Without getting into too much detail, there's a chart. It's attachment one. It's at the very back. And I think one of the things that the science program, I'll speak for the science program.
That's figure three?
That's figure three. Takes great pride in is the process. And the amount of review that goes into these, what we call PSPs, grant solicitations. So in any event, without getting into a lot of the details, you can take a look just for your reference, the kind of process okay. that this went through.
All right. Okay. Yes, Mr. Bruce Collins.
Cliff, focusing on attachment one, figure three, it does show that the selected research will begin in 2011. How does that research relate to our development of our plan?
That is exactly the timeline, I think, relative to doing the process that Chris just mentioned to you is going to take basically until the end of this calendar year to get those awards out the door. Research will start probably in the beginning of 2011. Those projects will generally be three-year-long projects, so we will have some information, but it will not be finalized or will not have complete final reports. One of the things that we as a science program try to do is get semi-annual reports so that we can actually provide information as we get it to the council, but it will not be a completed process in time for the Delta plan for this PSP.
Mr. Natale.
Yeah, just a question on that, recognizing obviously the, you know, the lead time here, there's no way that there can be any expediting to this. I think you pointed out yesterday and just now in your response that, you know, we're going to have some, you know, we have the benefit of the work that's been done thus far and in some of this work as it's underway, but, you know, to have them just get started in 2011 when we're going to be working on a Delta plan with the goal of having that done by January 1 of 2012, then, you know, that's going to make it very, very tight. Is there any way, maybe it's not you to answer that, Cliff, but is there no way that we can, you know, have these out by, you know, end of second quarter or third, at least beginning of third quarter of this year, so at least there's some work in the fall that could be done versus looking at the end of the calendar year start?
The process that we use is basically modeled after the peer review type of process that you would find, for example, at the National Institute of Health or the National Science Foundation. Accelerating that process is probably pretty challenging, but what we do try to do and what we do have are resources available for more directed studies where we can actually go with the topic in mind to individuals and experts and get them on board to work on that immediately, and we can facilitate that, I think, much more quickly than this actual full solicitation of proposals, receiving the proposals, reviewing the proposals, making decisions on after the review of the proposals, and then making the awards. So that would be a mechanism or a pathway where we could help with getting information in a little more expedited manner.
Was that something you could then report back to us on, and where that might be, those particularly focused areas that you could get the jump start on that? Because I think that's important. It sounds like now with the unfreezing of the money that the dollars are not the issue here. $8 million is, you know, a significant sum of money, but if you could jumpstart that procedurally wise, it seemed to me that would be in the best interest of what we're tasked with here, but certainly in the best interest of the discussion we're going to have with all the parties and, you know, in the months to come. So I guess I for one, Mr. Chair, would certainly encourage us to try to do that wherever possible. And where it makes sense, not compromise any of the work that needs to be done in the way you vet that. So
And I guess the point I would make is that we, as a science program, will be looking to you as a council to help us work through what some of those areas of specialized emphasis might be.
Well, but Cliff, we want absolute certainty beyond a reasonable doubt,
yep.
Never to be varied, and absolute predictability.
Yeah, ranked percentages, and
you
all
got
those
it.
Kind
the
of
whole
things.
Thing.
You bet.
The whole
Everything.
Thing.
You got it.
Okay. Well, we at least have the escape valve in the statute that says that we must use the best available science, which is a common phraseology. I noticed in those Texas and Florida statutes on water flows, there was comparable language. But I think it's also wise to note Supervisor Natoli's point, because there will be some things where we may want to make a focused request for information from our consultants. Now, that's not a peer review study. It lacks some of the credibility, but there'll be issues selectively drawn that we'll want to talk to the consultants about over time. And I don't know, I suspect not all of these would fit in that category, but some might.
I think you probably have three vehicles that you can consider. You can go to the consultants and the expertise that the consultants bring to the table. You could go to the science program, and we could identify experts that we know of that would help facilitate getting information on a topic. And then the other thing is you can come to the science staff themselves who have expertise and have them help you provide information. And those are three mechanisms by which we can move forward. We certainly, one of the things we do well is convene workshops of experts on various topics to try to get a good sounding board, open and public, of these issues. And we can then provide the council with reports or feedback from those meetings.
Mr. Fiorini, Mr. Roos Collins, Mr. Grindstaff.
Cliff, it also seems to me there's a fourth option, and that's the library of work that's already been done that would address many of the issues that we will be contemplating as we develop our plan.
I think you're right, particularly the synthesis, analysis, and communication of that information is probably which would be most valuable to you, because there is a tremendous body of information out there on the Delta.
Cliff, if I could summarize, I think you can get the sense that the council is really deeply interested in getting this information. I think it could be pivotal to the recommendations that we make. And anything you can do to shortcut the process, I mean, it's not the NIH. The NIH doesn't have the same deadline that we have. It's a little bit closer. We would certainly be appreciative.
Okay, understood.
Bruce Collins?
Cliff, it may be early for staff to develop nicknames for council members, but I warn you, I'm a tireless nag on the topic of time.
Tireless nag.
Tireless nag.
Tireless. On the topic of time.
I would like that in the minutes of this meeting, please. Self-description.
He's TNTT.
And so following up on the comments that you've just heard, let me make one further specific recommendation, which is that staff consider whether there are interim work products which our chosen consultants could deliver that could inform the development of the plan. So, for example, the plan must include performance standards. Mm-hmm. Could these consultants provide interim work products that might assist us in the development of those performance standards? Come back to us with some further thinking about that possible connection.
Yeah.
Thank you. Performance measures, evaluation programs, integrated monitoring, those are the kinds of issues that I know that going forward we need to be addressing.
Cliff, you and I have talked about this before, but I'm increasingly inclined to think it would be useful in some subject areas, maybe ones where you think there's general concurrence and agreement, to simply have a listing not of everything but representative existing studies of the best available science on this issue or that issue, and have it really in a compendium. Because my instinct is, when we do the Delta plan, when we do the interim plan, our choices are going to be premised on, to a significant extent, the best available science, and therefore enumerating the highlights of research and study would be useful. And secondly, on the choice of whether to incorporate or not all or some of the ingredients of other agencies, workforce studies, the flood control stuff we heard about yesterday. And I know, as a matter of public policy, political debate tends to fragment issues into discrete elements that you spend your time running after them, but the broad thematics, that's what Don's talking about. warrant the listing on one, two pages of paper, say, look, here are the 10 main scientific studies over the last X years. There seems to be broad concurrence, if not total agreement. Not to drive you to a conclusion, you know, on the political characterizations of issues, but that inventory of what are, in your judgments, you and the Independent Science Board, the best available science in these categories would be very useful to have. And even to piece out the things that we all kind of take for granted now. God knows what they are. I'm looking for tools to refer to when we start debating issues. Should we include this or not include this? I want to say, what government plans are available? How long have they been there? Are they preliminary plans? Are they final plans? What's the review behind it? Kind of a summary shorthand. And then the seminal studies, in your judgment, that provide a reasonable best available science. I understand interested parties will submit their own list of suggested science that drives different conclusions, but that's how I'd like to process for the next 20 months that, and it'd be very helpful, very helpful. I don't think that's inconsistent with your approach as to what you think science can and should provide.
No, I also would point out that you have another outstanding lead scientist in Anke Mueller-Silger who brings a lot of information about what other agencies are doing, and that we would definitely want to engage her in this process.
Well, my goal is to have a consolidated statement of the best available science. Not everything, obviously, but the seminal documents, whatever. Joe, what do you think?
I agree with that. I just wanted to point out one of the reasons why we left additional money in our proposed budget for the Delta Plan was so that we could potentially use that for these kinds of directed science efforts. So we have resources as we identify these issues to go out and get answers at least as best we can over that time period. That clearly was something we thought about as we were trying to move ahead with that contract.
Okay. Other questions? Anyone in the audience like to speak on this issue? Anyone like to speak on this issue? Is there a motion? Mr. Ruscomb?
Second.
Ms. Gray? On the motion to accept the report and recommendations under item number 13?
13.
We'll call the roll.
Natoli, aye.
Eisenberg, aye.
Gray, aye.
Fiorini, aye.
Ruth Collins, aye.
Nordhoff, aye.
Okay, 6-0 on that. Just as a note, Mr. Johnson had a meeting that has been long scheduled. He could not cancel that meeting. And we'll all have conflict problems periodically, but we'll accommodate as best we can. Okay, good. Thank you very much, Cliff. All right, Mr. Grindstaff, tell us about item number 14, which is all related to what we've been talking about.
It is. We have two departments who are about ready to go out with their own solicitation processes for restoration grants in the Delta. And in my view, they will probably spend more money over the next 2 years actually doing work in the Delta than anybody else. So we thought it would be appropriate if they came and talked about what it is they're planning to do. So we have both the Department of Fish and Game and the Department of Water Resources here today, and I don't know which one's first. I should probably...
Well, our agenda says DWR is A and DFG is B, but I don't think that's mandatory. Who knows?
DWR, go ahead.
You have been designated as the money bags, or one of them, for restoration, I noticed, by Mr. Grindstaff.
Well, good morning, Council. Good morning. Thank you, Chairman Eisenberg and Council members, for the opportunity to speak. I'm standing in for Mike Miramizahari. He called me this morning, and he was very ill. So my apologies for his absence. I will try and fill in and do the best that I can to give you the information that you need to know about.
And for the record, you are?
I'm David Meraz. Sorry about
Dave's
that.
Dave's actually Mike's supervisor, if I'm...
Could we read some of the performance evaluations you wrote?
Well, at any rate, if we can go to the next slide, please. I'd like to talk a little bit about the Delta Levees program and what are our program goals. To reduce the risk of to land use and associated economic activities, water supply, infrastructure, and ecosystem from habitat or from catastrophic breaching of Delta levees. So the Delta is an estuary, as you're well aware, and islands conjure up a thought of these mounds of material that rise above the ocean. In the Delta, we have bowls that subside below the ocean level, and those bowls are protected by 1,000 miles of levee. And that levee or that levee system is the only thing that keeps the Delta functioning for the state of California. The Delta Flood Protection Program has two major components. It's Delta Maintenance Inventions and Delta Special Flood Control Projects. Next one. And again. And one more. The subventions program is mainly for maintenance of the levees. It was instituted in 1973 by the Way Bill. In 1972, the Andrus Island failed and brought a lot of salt water into the estuary. And as a result of that, export pumping ceased. The pumps were shut down for about 2 weeks, and it took about 500,000 acre-feet of fresh water from storage to flush that salt out of the Delta and make the water usable again. At that point, the legislature recognized that there are a lot of farmers in the Delta that were poorly financed that were actually operating in the interest of the state by maintaining that levee system. So they set up a program to work cooperatively between the state and the locals to establish and maintain that levee, improve that system so that we can protect all of the statewide infrastructure that's there. The water code sections up there are the Delta Levee Subventions Program. Next one. If you just go ahead down the slide. There's been a number of funding sources over the years. There's been a number of cost-share arrangements, but the dollar values that you see up there, as you can see, are pretty modest, $10 million between 73 and 87. It's only been recently, since about Proposition 50, and that'll be back around 2006, where we started getting into large dollars. And currently we have, from Prop 84 and Prop 1E, about $750 million to spend in the Delta. Not all of it in the subventions program, but all of it will be spent in the Delta by various programs. Next slide. There's a partner program that's called Delta Special Flood Control Projects, and it was recognized again by the legislature in about 1988, that certain islands in the Delta are really critical islands, and they need more protection than just was available under a maintenance program. So the legislature asked the department to make a determination which islands those were, and then it cited two particular places, Walnut Grove and Thornton, that were in need of special flood prevention measures, and directed us to go ahead and take care of those islands. For many years, we've been doing that. Thornton and Walnut Grove have much improved flood protection, and there's 8 western islands that primarily contribute to export water supply that qualified for funding. Now, in 1996, there was authority given again by the legislature to take that special projects Delta-wide. So as long as there is a state interest, we can go out and work on any island in the Delta. However, until just recently, the funding was not such that we could supply all of the 8 western islands that were critical and additional Delta islands. So it's only been recently that we've opened the special projects up.
Is it the opinion of the Department of Water Resources that each and all Delta levies are equally important to the state?
No.
Okay. And we can talk about that later. The second thing is, do you have anywhere in here consolidated spending on Delta levies historically, federal, state, and local?
Looking, I think this is probably the best slide that you're going to get for special projects, and that's where most of the
right.
funding
is. Is it possible to ask you to give us something like a historical preview
yes.
with as much information as you can about the three sources of, so we can get
yes.
some
mm-hmm.
cosmic idea of how much all governments have spent on levy work, say for 30, 40 years, whatever your figures would go?
Yes.
That would be very useful. And I guess that would include emergency relief, disaster recovery mm-hmm. and stuff.
Yeah, and I think it would be useful if we actually segregate that into different areas, as was asked for yesterday. Recognize the Delta is not all exactly the same, and so you can see there's been maintenance costs, there's been this special program that Dave's talking about now. The Suisun Marsh has a separate program and hasn't been getting a lot of money. They would like, I think, to become a part of the program, and there's this difference between the Western Islands and the special projects right. have funded the Western Islands
Supervisor
more than
Natoli.
The rest of the Delta, so if that would probably be helpful to you.
If I could, I would just say to you, I think it's very important to point out that the legislation requires the matching, in most cases, from the reclamation districts, who are the
yes.
local landowners, in large part agricultural
yes.
islands that assess themselves at a fairly significant rate, certainly in recent years, because the $10 or $12 million didn't buy what it was buying back 10
right.
or 20 years ago. And I think it's very important because those are local landowners in large part of agriculture, but you do have communities. And I wanted to ask you, David, about Walnut Grove, because Walnut Grove is the only town that is split on both sides by the Sacramento
yes.
River. You have the east side and you have the Clampett Track. And so when you said Walnut Grove was the focus, was it both sides of the river, or was it the Grand Island side or the east side?
I believe it was primarily on the Grand Island side.
Okay.
Well, I'm sorry.
The east side by
on the east side.
By the cross
yes.
channel.
Yes.
I think, again, because the geography is important, but certainly the reference to what DWR does in providing the program, which is assisted, no question about
yes.
it, but there is a significant commitment by the local landowners and property owners and residents and farmers in those islands that put up a, you know, and I think to Phil's point about, and Joe's as well, get that kind of cumulative sum, because there have been a
yes,
lot
sir.
Of state dollars in there, but there's been a whole lot of local dollars in there as well.
Yes. That's up until the funding came in from Prop 50, 84, and 1E. I believe the local funding exceeded the state funding. And without the farmers...
For maintenance, for sure, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
But I think that's for both programs.
Yeah.
Without the farmers out there attending to the levees on a daily basis, we'd be sunk a long time ago. So they are indispensable.
Excuse me, Mike. What makes some islands more important than others?
Well, as you look at individual islands, there are some that are almost postage stamp size, a couple of hundred acres, that have no impact on either housing, on water supply, on highways, on infrastructure, pipelines, gas fields. They really exist in the Delta. They're farmed or they're used for recreation, but they're isolated.
So if the levees were to come down, it wouldn't make any difference to the overall condition of the Delta?
It would have probably minor hydrologic or hydraulic impacts. It could have some significant habitat impacts, but as far as the infrastructure that the state is concerned, primarily concerned with, would have no impact at all.
Okay.
Continuing on, next slide, please. This is just a timeline of the things that we've recently gone through, and the probably the most important are the two right boxes, where we've had funding given to us by Proposition 84 and 1E, and then further detailed out by the legislature to accomplish certain things. Using these funds, we've put out two proposal solicitation packages. one of them to deal with the structural aspects of the Delta levees. That package has gone to the local agencies. We've received the submittals in. We're in the process of evaluating them according to guidelines. And within the next month or two, we'll be coming out with our grants. There's also a PSP out right now for habitat grants. We have $15 million, and I believe the funding source is Proposition 1E. We do have a set of guidelines out there that talks about using the funds for planning, implementation, and design. I hope they design it before they implement it. But anyway, that's out there right now. The closing date is May 24th, and the Reclamation districts and interested parties are aware of it. I do have a website that I can provide. Unfortunately, it's not in this slide. Next slide, please. There have been a number of items that we've done as a program that I think contribute directly to the council's interest. One of them is the Delta Risk Management Strategy. DREAMS was broken into two phases. The first phase is the risk analysis, and it was intended to analyze the risks to the state resulting from failure of levees in the Delta due to a variety of reasons, and determine the consequences to the state in economic terms and ecosystem terms. I think we did a pretty good job on the economic terms. I think I'm probably not speaking too far out of school, for the ecosystem was not done as well as we would have hoped. Still needs more work. We did identify a number of risks and the risks are not necessarily the risks to the folks that live in the Delta themselves. It's more a look at how does the state of California suffer when things happen in the Delta. So we've had a little bit of consternation about, well, it doesn't appropriately characterize this one island. That may be the case, but overall it characterizes the risk to the state. So there are those that believe that there are flaws in the report, and for a report as voluminous as it is, I don't doubt that. But I think overall the conclusions are well-founded, and it's a source of information that I think will be a gold mine for you. Next slide, please.
It's also, I think, the latest available study of just the simple ownership patterns, cropping patterns, assessed valuation, acreage of island by island,
yes.
Which is surprisingly difficult to accumulate and took them a long time. And yes. I assume we'll be looking at that, too.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a question about that. Does that report show ownership of levees, either by region or by island? Within the Delta?
The levees belong, well, let me back up here. I'm talking a little bit out of my league, so if your attorney would correct me where I'm wrong. The reclamation districts are the ones that operate and maintain the levee systems. They're state agencies. Each one of them is independent, and they report to the landowners on the islands. Now, generally speaking, the land is in ownership of a farmer or a family, and the reclamation district has an easement to place that levee and operate and maintain that levee over the top of their land. So ownership is kind of one of those, of ownership of the levee is kind of a, I don't know how to describe it, but it belongs in segments to the individual parcel owners on which the levee sets. Am I reasonably close?
Let me ask a follow-up that may be more appropriate to Mr. Sandino, and that is, does this report or any other that DWR has prepared analyze which levees carry with them liability for the state under Paterno and similar cases?
Well, I'm not an attorney, so I'll only give you my opinion. We have been very well aware of paternal liability And we recognize that we have it for the levees that are part of the state plan of flood control. And there's about 380-some miles of project levees in the Delta for which we have that responsibility. The remainder of the levees, approximately 800 miles, are in private hands. And the state has been providing funding for many years. And one of the conditions on all of our work agreements is that the state is to be held harmless from any responsibility. We always go through the reclamation district. We give them the money. They have their own engineering staff. They have their own contractual capability. They have their own contractors come out and do the work. They manage the whole everything that goes on with respect to the levee system that they own and operate. So we've been trying to keep an arm's length relationship with them as far as taking on additional liability for the state.
Mr. Fiorini.
David, where does the Army Corps of Engineers come into this whole process?
Yeah, the Army Corps of Engineers has some responsibility for the levees that are part of the state plan of flood control. They've been authorized in federal legislation to work on non-project levees just recently. They've got a couple of levee systems that they're looking at, Bethel Island and McCormick Williamson, and I believe there's one other that I don't recall off the top of my head. But they have not come into the Delta in a large way at all. So they're making their first forays into it. We're meeting with them on a couple of specific projects. So they're still kind of out there treading water. The Corps of Engineers does come in when there's an emergency. In Jones Tract, they were in just a little tiny bit, and I think it's to protect federal interests. We have to comply with Stafford Act, I believe it is. So.
Supervisor Natoli.
Yeah, I just wanted to weigh in, and kind of goes at least a bit to the question about not only ownership, but on top of most of the levees, and I'll certainly speak to the Sacramento County portion, but I think this holds true for a good part of the Delta in its entirety. The road system, for the most part, that resides on top of those levees is maintained by the local jurisdiction. There are some state highways, and then there are some private roads. And those are the roads that are the farm to market. They're for the school buses. They're for the local traffic. And when we do have work that goes on, there's a need to have a cooperative effort, because a lot of times when they go in and do levee repairs, the asphalt surface is the responsibility of the county, and we've had to work out agreements with any number of reclamation districts, because again, you could leave that in a gravel condition, but then you become a real deterrent to certainly your recreational traffic. You look at in Brandon Andrus, and you mentioned Andrus, but we have any number of marinas down there, but throughout the Delta, that local road grid, there are some that cross the islands. But for the most part, it ties in with the state system with 160 and 12, and all the rest of those are local roads. And so it's cooperative. And so your local jurisdictions, cities as well, have a major investment in that infrastructure that resides on those levees. And you can talk about, you know, what might fail or not. You can begin to interrupt the ability for people to just move the mobility throughout the Delta, let alone what it might do to the interior of the island. So I think it's important to keep that in mind, that there's a local investment beyond the reclamation districts and whatever DWR or anybody else puts into it, on particularly on the road system that resides on the top of most of those levees throughout the Delta.
That's correct.
This is a good discussion, because it points out the different interest that focus on the same questions, existing levees. Different people benefit in different ways for different reasons, but as with so much public policy, behind all of that is the question, who pays?
Yes.
And we haven't, you know, I think we're not going to get into the cost, but this part of DWR's work, flood levies and all of that, to upgrade to certain standards, which you'll talk about in a minute, cost a lot of money. There's just no way out of that, a lot of money. And every dollar the state spends for one thing is a dollar you can't spend for something else. And the question of local match at what level is deeply controversial. And you'll all be hit with it between the eyes if you haven't already.
Yes. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
continuing on with the Delta Risk Management Strategy, we have phase two that we're working on right now. And phase two is to develop risk reduction strategies for long-term management of the Delta. And again, I'll say that these are risk reduction strategies to that consider the state interest, not necessarily the local interest of the Delta. I mean, they're included, but we're more primarily focused on the state interest. We have a set of building blocks that we've determined could be effective or can be effective in reducing the incidence of levee failure. We've got a number of trial scenarios that we put together, and we're using a risk model to determine which one gives us the best performance. We're in the process of doing that now, and we do have interim reports that may be of interest. We plan to have the final report out at the end of the year.
Promise?
Well, depending the appropriation.
I mean, you understand, for our purposes,
yes.
The faster the report comes out, the more better the chance we have to integrate it in what we have to do.
Absolutely.
Okay.
The interim reports are pretty good. We have a couple of things that have happened since the interim reports were done, so we have to go back and capture that, which requires a little more work than just revising a couple of pages. So I'd be happy to share the interim information with you. Next slide. We talked just briefly about design standards. The focus of the Delta Flood Protection Program are the agricultural islands. Those are the ones that are predominant in the Delta. They're the ones that protect most of the state infrastructure. And we do have three standards that we work to. The first one at the bottom there is the Hazard Mitigation Plan standard that has a levee crest 1 foot above the 100-year floodplain. Not a high standard. 1.5 on one waterside slope, 16-inch width, and 2-on-1 landside slope. It's a bare minimum. Of the 80 islands that I've got listed in the Delta, there are 69 of them that do not meet that standard. The next standard is PL 8499, and for practical sense, there's about 6 inches difference. The crest is 1.5 feet above the 100-year flood. The backslope is dependent upon peat thickness. If you have a very deep peat foundation, then you have a flatter slope. If you have mineral soils, as they do along the eastern border of the Delta, then you can go with a flatter slope, or I'm sorry, a steeper slope. And the department developed a standard called the Bulletin 19282 Ag Standard that has 1.5 feet of freeboard on the 300-year water surface.
Freeboard.
Freeboard is the difference between water surface elevation and the crest of the levee. The 300-year water surface in the Delta is probably several inches higher than the 100-year water surface, so it's not a huge difference. Again, the landside slope is the big difference. It varies depending upon peat thickness underneath. For the urban islands, there's a FEMA standard where they have 3 feet of freeboard over.
You say an urban island. Would you explain an urban island?
An urban island in the department's consideration is an island that would have 5,000 to 10,000 people on it.
Yeah. These are, Supervisor Natoli and others often call them the heritage towns, the smaller towns in the Delta, the aggregation of people, and then the kind of oddities like Bethel Island, which is a recreational boating houseboat plopped on the corner of Contra Costa County and one of the most threatened areas in the state.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But intensely developed.
Mm-hmm. But you don't have 5,000 people in Walnut Grove or Corbin,
no.
Or you cumulative, you're going to get a hard time getting to 10,000. So you still basically have agricultural levees with some urban kind of retrofit along some of the major corridors, but there's that.
Absolutely.
And that's where we're getting caught with FEMA, very frankly. This is the big squeeze right now with our local towns, is that try to do an urban standard in a largely rural area with a township, the costs are just the rise of the clouds.
But the FEMA, Federal Emergency Management, it's all the federal grants after disasters to get you back on your feet.
But they're trying to drive that standard for in a lot of the rural areas, and it.
This is so controversial and so important that it brings in everything. So, for example, Don's comment about development, a small town like Walnut Grove. Well, if they have to make a match, even if it's a relatively low proportion of match for spending, the higher the standard of flood protection, the costlier it is. The more they have to pay, the less they're able to pay. One way they approach it is, well, let's add the proposal to add 1,000 houses down there. Well, then what you've done is you've created a higher, a risk for a larger number of people. And although the state of California makes very clear that it is not conceding paternal liability in each and every island in the state of California, attorneys stay up at night puzzling about what judges might do with that. And so it's nuts. This whole system is absolutely nuts. And we talk about standards like 100-year flood protection as if that's in the Netherlands, their highest urbanized areas will often provide 10,000-year flood protection. We battled, and the legislature finally said, kind of moved sort of maybe fast to a 200-year protection for some levees. And that was deeply controversial because it implies people might have to spend more money. And maybe you just ought to shoot out a figure on cost of, mile per levee.
Well, the cost just to maintain them is all over the board. They'll go anywhere from about $3,000 per levee mile to $20,000 per levee mile. As far as improving them to let me get to the radical one. Seismicity is a real problem in the Delta, and in order to make it seismically repairable, you're talking about $25 to $35 million per levee mile.
Yeah, and you said seismically repairable. You didn't say seismically immune, right?
Well, I should have said seismically resistant. The seismically repairable, the one that we expect to fail but will be able to come back and repair quickly, I think that's down to around $15 to $20 million per mile.
Mr. Bruce Collins.
David, do you have an estimate how much it would cost to bring all of the islands into compliance with the minimum agricultural standard?
HMP?
Correct. You said that you said that 69 out of 80 islands don't meet that standard. What would it cost to bring them into compliance with it?
It's surprisingly not very expensive. We're talking about static loading only, and we're talking about isolated segments of each of these islands. So we're thinking it can be done for about $60 million.
60?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Kreinstadt?
Yeah, I'd like to just clarify for those of you that haven't been involved in the world of flood management for a long time, what all these basic terms are that we're using. FEMA is the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and in order for a county after a disaster or any city to qualify for assistance from the federal government after the disaster, they have to abide by FEMA standards, which means that they have to say you can't develop in areas where you don't meet the standards. So for the counties, and cities, any community, that's a really significant issue. The reason HMP is a really significant issue for the Delta is if you're in an agricultural area and correct me if I'm wrong, if you're in an agricultural area and you didn't meet that standard and it failed, you may not be eligible for any funds for repairs afterwards. If you meet that standard and you're in an agricultural area, then you potentially are eligible for federal relief. So these are very serious issues. I mean, for people in the Delta, getting every island up to HMP standards is really a critical thing because they know then, okay, if we have a disaster, we can get federal dollars to help us repair these levees.
Yeah. It is primarily attractive for that reason, not for the independent protection issue. It's okay, but it doesn't add
no,
a lot.
I think that's accurate. It is primarily because of the potential financial issues, not because it is that much more safe.
And this discussion also mirrors what has been an ongoing political discussion, trying to figure out how you can get things done. And one of the issues that the locals have argued strongly for is, well, you at least ought to help us out on HMP for qualifications, although we don't like the other things you're talking about at the same time.
Right.
Yeah.
HMP, I'm not sure what that stands for.
Hazard Mitigation Plan.
Ah, there it is.
Thank you. Thank
I'm
you.
Sorry.
Thank you. By the way, these charts, you will actually look at this little chart or a version of it several times, and it'll drive you crazy, but it's pretty important stuff.
Mr. Chair, at some future meeting, it might be helpful. We heard Mr. Cosio, who's an engineer for a lot of the recommendations, but it might be good, and they're certainly welcome to attend any meeting, but to maybe schedule some time to have some of the local folks, and you certainly could, you know, have a handful come in from different parts of the Delta to talk about, you know, one, what they've gone through to make the investment in the levees and where they've been able to achieve some of the standards, certainly in cooperation with DWR. But I think the other, there's another piece here, too, that's important, and that is that they have been able to, and it was alluded to just a moment ago, to in lots of cases get the height and the width. But it's the seismic issue that's now becoming, particularly with that urban standards, that's really throwing a wrench in it. And the last point I would make that they could certainly tell you more about, they do know how to flood fight. That doesn't get built into the modeling, and it doesn't do something with a dry weather condition when something fails. But when it comes down to it, and we get a 1986 or a 1998 event, they know how to flood fight. And they know how to save the islands. They know how to everything from the wash to the, you know, the boils that occur. And it would be just probably very informative for this panel. Certainly Mr. Eisenberg's heard a lot about it through his work in the Delta Vision Task Force. But I would suggest that, you know, again, if we get lots of time at some future date, Mr. Chair, to hear from some of the locals, let them tell you from their own perspective.
All right. We will do that. Mr. Grindstaff, make a note, please. Ms. Ulrey, make a note, please. That's right.
If I might add, The locals are the local reclamation district. Their engineers and their supervisors are the ones that make the very first attack on any flood incident in the Delta. They're the ones that go out and identify the sites. They're taking their sandbag ring and putting it around. And once they get that first level of control in place, then they call for help. So they are absolutely critical to operation and maintenance of the system. If we can go to the next one. You might ask, you know, we've spent all this money. Wow. And what have we got for it? Go ahead and hit one more slide. Over the last 30 years, we've put little bits of funding. Whoops. Is there one more? There we go. Little bits of funding into the Delta through the Maintenance Subventions Program. And you wonder, how successful have you been? Well, on the left was the characteristic look of a Delta levee with the cracks down the midline, continuing subsidence and settlement. If you get that road wet, you'd be lucky to drive on it and stay on the levee crest. On the right, you can see that same section of levee today. It's a little bit different. You've got an all-weather driving surface. You've got riprap that protects against wave wash. The backside is flatter. I know it's a little bit more difficult to see in the picture, but it is.
That's the Nedgedly Bridge, which connects Lower Sacramento County to the little Contra Costa town, the big Contra Costa town of Antioch, and it's a new constructed bridge in the late 1980s, I think.
I'll have to.
As these go, and it's designed for ship channel passage of large ships, mostly to Stockton, the ones that go there anyway. The other thing the photograph doesn't quite show, but we were on that exact same levee 2 years ago, is that, of course, the land level is about 15, 20 feet below where you're standing. There's no experience quite like being on a levee and have a big ship pass you, and you look 60 feet up, and it's surreal. It is surreal. Very exciting, very interesting. Yeah. Very interesting.
Mr. Chair, if I just point out one other thing about that picture, I think it's illustrative, is that look at where the water is in relation to the top of the levee, mm-hmm. that even if you were in a a winter storm, you might see some wash. So, but that water doesn't get much. It gets up. I think the cursor, it will move, but it doesn't. It's not like that water. It spreads out there to San Joaquin, and you get. It stays relatively the same.
Yes.
You know, day right. in, day out.
That's one of the western, more westernly islands in the Delta.
Yes.
So when people talk about the most threatened islands, this happens to be one of them.
Yeah. This is Sherman Island, and it's the southwest levee. And the wave fetch, the amount of travel distance that a wave could travel is about a mile and a half. And I'll hurry on. I see the watch there. I had a point I was going to make, and I've completely forgotten it, so I'll just ask if there are any questions.
We've been abusing you with questions from almost the first minute you opened your presentation. I appreciate it. We're going to take a 10-minute recess. It is now 10:36. We will start at 10:46 once again. Okay? Let's do a recess. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, take your seats, please. Take your seats, please. Thank you very much. Okay. All right, we're turning off our cell phones because the professional crew standing in back is looking grimly in our direction. All right. Thank you very much. Heron Metters wants to talk to us from Delta Helen, I'm sorry, from Delta Cares. Yes, please.
Good morning. Just really, really quick on your stuff. I actually sit on the Delta work group for the Flood Safe, the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan, and I also sit on the subcommittee, the Joint Subcommittee for Agriculture. A lot of the questions that you have and the things that were brought up, the answers in the most current state are just getting ready to be published in the Regional Conditions Report. And in that report, each area of the watershed has gone through and identified the exact state of everything in there, the good, the bad, the whole nine yards. So that is a good document. It's about 400 pages long, but it's probably the most recent, and it will be coming out with the most accurate historical data on flood and what have you. And a lot of what you are doing and considering comes through flood management. So we can't really leave them out of the picture. And then the other thing that you were bringing up on the levees, to clarify a little bit, at least the way that I understand the difference between agricultural and urbanizing, there's three. Agriculture has those three levels that we talked about. Then you have urbanizing, which are areas within the Delta that are in the secondary zone, not the primary zone, but that are urban, which is 10,000 or more. And then urbanizing, which would be some of the ones that are tending to encroach. And that is if they plan to or think that they're going to have between 5 and 10,000 people in the next so many years. That is what determines the levy and the levy of protection. And part of the problem that we're coming up with FEMA coming in and demanding these things, is that they are making it very, very, as what Mr. Notoli has been saying, that in the borderline areas that a lot of the maintenance comes out of private pockets, FEMA is making it, they're going to bankrupt small towns and what have you if they continue on the path as a federal entity in our state and what we're doing. And quite frankly, I don't think it's nearly as critical or what have you. We've been protecting the levees and the Delta for decades. And so while some things are critical, they're not necessarily as let's move as fast as possible. But we do know how to fight floods, and we do know how to get in and make the repairs when we need to. And again, we go back to what we talked about, seismicity yesterday. So okay. Anyway, just to let you know that there are stuff out there, and we'd be more than happy to make sure as you get brought up to date or as current as possible, that there are myriads of things that go on with our water within the state. But we'll try to get as much information to you as possible. So that's all I want to say.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Can I ask a follow-up question, Ms. Metters?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thanks for the regional condition report reference.
Uh-huh.
Look forward to getting that. Do you know if flood insurance is available on islands that whose levees do not meet standards?
The way I lived on two islands out there. First, I lived on Upper Andrus, which, by the way, the Upper Andrus area taxed themselves and built a cross levee, and it was that cross levee on Upper Andrus that saved us from being flooded when Andrus Brandon Island flooded. So we're having been kind of proud of that. In 97, I lived across the backside of the island on Georgiana Slough where the boils came up, and then we also did the flood fight on Tyler Island as far as doing the baggings. Now, when I moved over to Grand Island, again, that island is probably, Reclamation District 3 is probably one of the best reclamation districts in the watershed. They taxed themselves over the years and built the pumping facilities to keep that water out, and they were able to take off the flood requirement. But with anything out there, with any property that you own, you buy that property. If you want flood insurance, nobody says you can't. You go out and buy your own flood insurance, and if something were to happen, that freak thing, that's the only way you're going to be covered. Now, there's islands out there that it is mandatory. Reclamation District 3, from my understanding, with the new FEMA standards, they lost that 100-year or the X factor, and now they're required for flood insurance. But my parents live there, and my mom, being who she is, she buys flood insurance for every home she owns. It doesn't matter where she lives. But so that's the way my understanding of flood insurance happens right now.
Okay. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Thank you. Okay. But wait, David, did you, we had talked about the activity, the grant package you're doing in Next Fish and Game. Maybe it's our title. DWR doesn't consider levee work ecosystem work, does it?
It does not. The Delta Levees program does have to result in net habitat enhancement.
No, I understand that.
So we do fund...
You do other things.
Yes.
Yeah.
And some of those are Decker Island. The northern tip of that was done with program funds.
Would you, for the members who haven't been exposed to it, a brief discussion of you do work on levee, you spend a lot of money, you improve the levees, you mitigate or do something somewhere else. Decker Island's a good example. Could you just give a shorthand on that?
Absolutely. The law requires that the Delta Levees program fully mitigate all of its environmental damages or unavoidable damages. We avoid those that we can, and result in net habitat enhancement. So each of our packages, when we evaluate them, we take a look at the mitigation and make sure that the Reclamation District did no long-term habitat damage. Where they have done something, then we work with Fish and Game to understand what the mitigation cost is, and then get that implementation or that mitigation implemented before the Reclamation District receives its funding. We have several out there now. Just one that I can recall that has had a long-term deficit until they fully mitigate to the satisfaction of Department of Fish and Game. They will not receive additional program funding. It's a pretty big stick. With respect to resulting in net habitat enhancement, the program has that as a mandate. So we, on Decker Island, for example, we saw the potential to take the dredged materials off of that island, use it to repair levees on Webb Track, Jersey Island, Bradford, and I think some of it went into Van Sickle, and then change the nature from land that's above sea level to land that's within the tidal zone. So we put
dendritic. And that means it's how far below the water level, roughly?
At water level and 5 feet below.
Okay. And are you doing restoration, marsh restoration there?
Yes.
This is a fairly new experiment that's going on in a number of places in the Delta, where in relatively shallow areas you're able to see a rapid growth of some plants closer to a native state, and that's the trade-off. Is this the one you're doing with UC Davis, or is that a different?
No, UC Davis, I believe, is the rice.
Oh, okay.
We're growing.
All right.
So Decker Island is one. Means Landing is another one. Dutch Slough is a third. We've got Grizzly Slough area. Each one of these has their own type of habitat. That's upland or tidal marsh or shaded riverine aquatic. And we pay for that out of the program funds 100% because there's the only interest a particular island may have in doing that kind of work is to qualify for the program. So we think it's only right that the program as a whole pick up that cost.
Are these mitigation expenditures ones that you work out jointly with Fish and Game and other state and federal agencies, so everyone says, oh, yeah, we like that one, too? Is that how it goes?
To the extent that that we can. I have to state that mitigation is a debt that's due because you remove some habitat in the process of doing your work. That's fully paid for by the reclamation district and the state at the agreed-upon cost share, and it's usually on the order of 75%. Enhancement is the things that's over and above the mitigation, and that's what's paid for by the program at 100%. And we've got those projects that I was talking about, Decker Island and the others. Those are enhancements, so it's over and above any mitigation debt. Now, we do work very closely with Fish and Game to identify the projects, make sure that they go in well, that they serve the purpose they're intended, and that they can be modified should that purpose not be achieved.
Okay. Mr. Grindstaff.
So, Dave, this grant solicitation package that is on the street now and that you plan to award.
Speak into the microphone,
please.
I'm sorry.
Is the grant solicitation package that you're going to be awarding here soon intended as ecosystem restoration grants for that purpose?
That's correct.
Okay.
And we'll get a look at that. When will it be available for us to look at?
Well, it is available right now on the web. Mm-hmm. Our intent is that the proposal would close on the 24th of May, and we'll be involved in selection of projects after that, and then they will be awarded hopefully before the end of the fiscal year.
My hunch is, members, I don't know what you think, but my hunch is we ought to take a look at it to see whether we can anticipate any advantage, disadvantage for the Delta plan. But secondly, the legislature told us to adopt an interim plan. God knows what that means. And we at least ought to look at it in that context, too. And so, Mr. Grindstaff, I think given the timetable for the department, we got to have our comments available for their consideration rapidly.
Agreed.
Rapidly. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank
I'm
you.
Sure Nancy got that.
Okay. All right. Fish and Game's around here somewhere. Mr. Wilcox.
I'm honored. I have a nameplate here. I didn't expect that.
Well, this means you're forced to sit in on all of our meetings.
I was afraid of that. But I would look forward to that in a way. In that,
yeah, only in a way.
Well, you know, we've had a close relationship through the CalFed process in the past and with the science program in particular. And we see us, the department, being very closely involved with the work that you do. And my program is involved in a lot of that. I'm Carl Wilcox. I'm with the California Department of Fish and Game. I'm the chief of the department's water branch. And the water branch is intimately involved in Delta activities. We do statewide water planning, or the department's participation in statewide water planning, and are responsible for developing the department's flow criteria recommendations that are required by the recent legislation. We're also the lead unit for department participation in the Bay Delta conservation planning process. And then also, we manage the ecosystem restoration program that was part of CalFed. And we have managed that since 2006. And I'm here to talk to you a little bit about our upcoming project solicitation in mid-2010. And what that would involve, and at the same time give you just a real brief touch background on the ecosystem restoration program as a, in general. The ERP focuses on the entire CalFed's focus area, so it goes from the rim dams includes the watersheds of the Sacramento and San Joaquin River systems, as well as the Delta and Suisun Marsh and the northern part of San Francisco Bay. So the projects that the ERP has implemented over time have been in these areas, and as part of the ecosystem restoration program plan, there are specific targets or milestones that were established for the first 7 years of implementation. We're just finalizing a brief summary report that summarizes about 700 pages of information about all the projects that have been funded, and that should be available here shortly. ERP has funded to date about $630 million worth of projects, and this is the entirety of the ecosystem ERP program, and predates 2000 with the formation of, or the formal adoption of CalFED, of which, of those projects, there were 490 to date. We continue to administer about 80 projects and are looking to develop some more that would continue to contribute to the overall rehabilitation of the system. 75% of the projects that have been funded to date have been completed. The types of projects range from fish screens. The program has spent in excess of $100 million over the period in screening primarily agricultural diversions in the Sacramento system and in the San Joaquin system, and done this in many cases in cooperation with the federal government and the CVPIA. We've also provided funding for fish passage, particularly in the upper tributaries. Probably the most important project that's ongoing is the Battle Creek restoration, which would open up about 48 miles of new habitat for winter run and spring run salmon, as well as steelhead. We've also provided substantial funding for wildlife-friendly agricultural projects in the Central Valley and in the Delta, and funded shallow water restoration projects, tidal marsh habitat projects. Unfortunately, most of those, well, not unfortunately, but fortunately for San Francisco Bay or the lower estuary, most of that has been done there. And I think when you look at the scale of restoration that came up earlier, you would be informed by looking at what's going on in San Francisco Bay, where they're aggressively restoring the diked baylands of San Francisco Bay, and in the South Bay have acquired most of those lands and are in the process of restoring thousands of acres. And in the Napa River system, have pretty much restored the whole lower watershed, which encompasses about 10,000 acres. So these are substantial, large-scale ecosystem restorations that are guided by a goals process that was completed about 1999 and laid out a vision for habitat restoration in that system and up into Suisun Marsh. We've also funded substantial riparian floodplain restoration and research and planning projects and invasive species activities, which aren't shown on that brief list. Major accomplishments in the Delta and Suisun Marsh have been tidal wetlands restoration, and again, this is primarily in San Pablo Bay, but some work in Suisun Marsh. The ERP program funds the development of the Suisun Marsh Restoration Management Plan that's currently underway, and the environmental document should be coming out shortly. We've also contributed the conservation of more than 17,000 acres in the Eastern Delta. This is projects like Stanton Island, the acquisition of that island, the McCormick-William Williamson Tract, and some other lands there. Most of those, in the case of Stanton Island, is still in agriculture and wildlife-friendly agriculture. McCormick-Williamson is slated for, at some point, for restoration into floodplain and enhanced intertidal habitats. And then development of what we refer to as the DREERIP models. These are conceptual models that for species and habitats that represent the state of the science.
DREERIP. What does that acronym
stands
mean?
For Delta Regional Ecosystem.
Rest in peace.
Restoration Implementation Plan. It was originally supposed to be an implementation plan for restoration in the Delta, but became primarily the development of a set of conceptual models about that are used for evaluating actions or describing actions and describing the kinds of things that should be monitored or assessed as part of those actions. So they're useful tools. We continue to work with the science program on continuing their development and their long-term maintenance as tools to help us with adaptive management in the Delta in the future. Other accomplishments of the program have been protection and restoration of 15,000 acres of riparian and shaded river green aquatic habitats on 77 miles or so in the ecosystem, in the watersheds. A lot of work in the bypass, particularly related to methylmercury. The program has funded, I think, $30 million worth of mercury-related research. And then assistance to farmers, both within the Delta and in the watersheds, to do wildlife-friendly projects. Shortcomings that we've identified have really focused on the we've done a lot in the watersheds, and I think this came out at the end of stage one review that was done by the Bay Delta Authority back in 2007 or so. And we've done a lot for salmon and a lot for riverine habitats. But in the Delta, we've done very little from an aquatic habitat restoration perspective. And so the focus of what we're proposing to do with this PSP would be to look for projects in the Delta to address these types of issues. Just as background, and I think you probably got a little bit of it yesterday in Anka's presentation, about 1-2% of the historic tidal habitat remains in the Delta, so there's very little. And putting some of that back seems to be a fairly effective method if done right. And that's the big caveat, at helping to restore the Delta ecosystem. Again, most of the work that had been done was done upstream in the tributary areas. So our solicitation package is looking for projects primarily that would look at the Delta and the Sassoon. And the focus is guided by the existing ERP documents, the CalFed Record of Decision, the various strategic plans for the ERP, an updated conservation strategy that the department and its federal counterpart agencies have been working on for the last 3 years or so to guide us in updating what we would do in stage two based on what occurred in stage one. And that specifically looked at the Delta and Sassoon Marsh to help us formulate our ideas of how we should provide input to other planning processes, particularly BDCP. A lot of these projects are projects that carry through from the earliest days of CalFed and through to today. And they're things that, don't change. They're the same types of actions that have been recommended along most of the steps in the process. And are currently being evaluated as part of the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. Priorities, again, restoration and enhancement of functional aquatic habitat, floodplain primarily, and tidal and subtidal habitats in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta and Sassoon Marsh. We'll probably also be looking at projects upstream that fit in that category. And then research that looks at addressing the uncertainties that are associated with habitat restoration. And as part of the BDCP process, many of the conservation measures that were have been identified in that process, have been evaluated using the DREERIP models, and there are uncertainties and issues that were identified that needed to be addressed to provide greater levels of certainty about what we would get out of these. So research, applied research that would be tied to these restoration actions that would help us better understand and help us what we're getting from these, and are we getting the kinds of things that we're expecting to get out of them. And also to help address some of the issues that were raised by the National Research Council review of the OCAP biological opinions. So the review and selection process, we're still in the process of developing the PSP. We expect to have it ready and post it for review and comment in the next month or so.
By May, do you think?
Well, yeah, I think
June,
probably
May,
by
June?
In June. We would like to get it posted for review and then get it posted shortly after the first of the fiscal year in July to actually start getting it out there for people to submit proposals. Once we've received those, probably in October, then we would be looking at an administrative review. Our process is very similar to the process that's described for the science program PSP. All of the CalFed programs have a similar way of soliciting and reviewing those projects. And so once we go through that process of external scientific review, goes to what's called the ERPIMs, or the ERP implementing agency managers, they would review those and make recommendations. We bring that selection back to the council for your input, and then the department would work on awarding the grants. The timeline, again, posting the solicitation in July of 2010, with proposals due in October, and then the review process. We have about $35 million we're expecting to have available for projects. And that's it.
Let me just ask you a question. When the legislature passed the bill package last year, they included a section called Early Actions, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and it referred to the council, it referred to the Department of Fish and Game, it referred to Department of Water Resources, and also to the Water Board. Is this RFP, which I guess is for $30 million roughly worth of projects?
Depending on our budget allocation.
No, I understand. But your hopes is for $30 million. Is it your judgment that all of the proposals will be designed to meet the criteria of the early action components of the legislation?
Our intent is that that would be the case. We're trying to define these as, or find projects that would contribute to meeting kind of the no regrets types of projects that have been identified in the past. Many of those are currently being funded.
No regret means, in parentheses, mean everybody says it's kind of okay, or at least nobody says they hate it. It's the quest for the eternal, universally agreed upon project, which almost never works, but it's a good goal, right?
Right. So, there are a number of projects that are out there. We're looking at trying to find others. We have a list of things that we're already working on. As I mentioned, we have 80 ongoing projects, and we have a number that are in the Delta that we continue to work on. And we're looking for things that would help to contribute to early implementation of the objectives of BDCP from a habitat perspective.
Are you guys online to recommend your flow criteria to the Water Board?
Yes.
Okay, so you'll meet the deadline in the statute?
Yes, that's our intent. We're working very closely with the Water Board. We have provided submittals to the Water Board for their February informational deadline. We participated on their technical panels at the workshops in March and provided summaries of our comments here a few weeks ago to meet the April 15th deadline. So, and then we're working very closely with the Water Board to assure that to the maximum extent feasible or possible that their and our recommendations are the same, so that we do have a three-month difference in when we're supposed to be issuing our flow recommendations from the State Board, but we're trying to do it in synchrony. And then we have an additional charge, which is to identify biological objectives, and we're working on that and have introduced some of that thinking into the State Board process.
Okay, Mr. Nordhoff, Mr. Fiorini, Mr. Roos Collins, Ms. Gray.
Thank you, sir. When you have a project to restore or improve the functional aquatic habitat of a certain area, what criteria do you use? In other words, what metrics do you have to know that you've finished, you've achieved your objective?
Well, that's a good question. You know, relative to establishing performance measures, to a great degree, we rely on examples of what historic condition looks like and what the historic attributes of the type of habitat we're restoring, what the historic template looked like.
So you're talking about macro stuff.
I'm talking about macro stuff.
As opposed to micro, like the nutrient loading in the water and things like that. I mean, you can't restore that to the way it was.
We can't put it back exactly, but we're looking to restore the attributes. One of the differences between what happens in San Francisco Bay is that things aren't so subsided there. You still have, in many cases, the template of the former geomorphic features that once you put the water back in, it starts to restore. Here, much of that has been lost through subsidence. So if we restored, Delta Islands without raising them back up, we'd have an inland sea. So in many cases, we're targeting our restoration at the periphery, where the elevations are suitable. So you're looking for suitable elevations, suitable hydrodynamics. Looking at criteria that would identify what you would expect from the perspective of what kind of vegetation, what the hydraulics look like, and then monitor that. One of the things that is in the most recent science news is a description of the BREACH project, which is being funded.
This is our publication, the science news publication that's done by the Independent Science Board. And I think is a copy in this packet? The copy is in this packet, I believe. Yeah. Yep.
So one of the things that the ERP program is funding is the BREACH 3 studies, which are designed specifically to look at the major restoration in the delta for tidal, intertidal, subtidal habitat, which is Liberty Island. It wasn't a purposeful restoration. It restored itself in that the levees breached. But now we're going in and trying to understand how that system works. We have snippets of information which haven't been synthesized yet, which I think is a point that Cliff makes prominently, is that we really need to synthesize the information we have now that indicate that that's a really good place for a lot of delta fishes. It has the environmental characteristics that they like. It may or may not be more productive than the delta as a whole, and there are issues surrounding that relative to predation. And so this study is looking at the hydrodynamics, the food web, and all of those things to help us provide a better understanding of how these restorations would work and how we should target them.
Earlier today, we used the concept of what's best for California. Do you ever do a cost-benefit analysis of this? In other words, what's the benefit having done something like that? Who benefits?
Well, I think if you look at the discussion that's going on in San Francisco Bay and in many places of the world, we're looking at the benefits of these tidal marshes, these natural wetland habitats in the tidal zone relative to how they ameliorate climate change. They sequester carbon. They sequester contaminants. They provide ecosystem support for commercial fisheries, recreational fisheries, ecotourism, fish and wildlife interests, recreational benefits. They also provide buffers from sea level rise and serve to protect the levee infrastructure that we may have in many cases. You know, you look at the levees in the Delta, they're riprap structures. There's nothing to buffer them from wind fetch and those types of things. So,
have we ever tried to quantitate those benefits?
I haven't personally, no, but there's literature that documents that those attributes, at least qualitatively and not necessarily quantitatively, but I'm sure there is literature out there, and Cliff may know much better than I.
Well, there's certainly there are advocacy documents on all sides that attempt to quantify the benefit of a particular position. I don't recall, Joe, is there anything definitive?
I don't think in this estuary I have seen a definitive document that clearly goes on our list that Nancy's writing down to research more. I think one of the fundamental things that we all assume is that it is public policy to have those co-equal objectives met, and for lots of reasons, and so we haven't spent as much time worrying about what the financial benefits are of achieving that public policy.
Well, in times of scarce financial resources right now, I mean, we know how much money we're spending. You know, we can quantitate that. It could be a very powerful thing to try to put, and I say try to put because it's not going to be precise, a dollar value on the benefits, on the results of that.
I agree.
I can tell you when I was doing the Marine Life Protection Act first task force that went on for almost 3 years in the central coast of California, we did do something of that because interest came in and argued that their economic benefit was not being properly reflected. But ultimately, we came down to a gigantic fight between fishing interests, both commercial and sports fishing, who said they are economically more valuable than simply preservation of the environment. And then the environmentalists got all agitated and excited and presented endless studies on recreation, tourism, and other activity. I concluded that, you know, if the advocates are trying to accumulate the information, it is endlessly compromised on all sides. And they all resort to a multiplier effect. The answer that, it may only be $4.95, but the multiplier effect is 18 million times that amount. I lost faith in that discussion. That is not to say we shouldn't do it. But I've been exposed to some pretty...
I think with the right people and the right mandate, I mean, it may take several lifetimes to get some data that we all agree on.
You're going to sound like Phil now, Hank.
Yeah, right. Mr. Fiorini.
I don't have a question.
Ah, but you touched your microphone. Mr. Bruce Collins, then Ms. Gray.
Carl, good to see you. Does the department have a management strategy for invasives that affect Delta fish?
There is the department has a invasives management plan that's part of the state plan. It's online. It doesn't specifically target Delta fish. You know, in many cases, the invasives, you know, the focus of that plan is keeping invasives out and not so much, you know, there once, as was indicated earlier, once things are established in the system, they become very difficult to control or eradicate. One of the possible exceptions for that is the Atlantic cordgrass or introduced cordgrass in San Francisco Bay and the control efforts there. But for invertebrates or even some of the aquatic weeds that, like Egeria in the Delta, those become very problematic to control and have side negative effects once they're in the system in a large way. So it's primarily targeted at preventing introductions. But as far as am I getting at what you want?
Well, let's turn to treatment with respect to the invasives that are already there. Does the department have a plan for treatment of those invasives?
No. We work with the Department of Food and Agriculture, particularly in the Department of Boating and Waterways for the control of aquatic weeds, water hyacinth, egeria, and those types of things. But for control of other types of introductions other than things like northern pike and Lake Davis, which if allowed to get into the system, it's not some place where they're controlled and you can actually treat them. If they'd been introduced into the system, we probably couldn't have been able to deal with them just because of the scope and their plasticity as a species and a predator. But in Lake Davis, after two tries and many millions of dollars, we were able, and a whole campaign to work with the locals, we were able to eradicate pike from that reservoir and out of the Sacramento watershed. So in those cases, we do. But in general, we're not out trying to control corbula, the introduced freshwater clam. It's there. It fluctuates in the system, and it's not something we're going to be able to get rid of.
Ms. Gray.
Yes. My question has to do, again, with the functional aquatic habitat. And I know that you talked about how to measure, that was a question, even the benefit. But can you explain the whole process, what that means?
Of functional aquatic habitat?
Right.
Okay. Well, it's creating habitat of the appropriate constituents, going back to the hydrology of the site, particularly for these intertidal habitats. So you have appropriate tidal influence, you have appropriate substrates for the development of aquatic plant establishment, emergent marsh vegetation. You have an appropriate template for water circulation within the area, appropriate connection to the broader delta so that there's an exchange, an appropriate exchange. You have the appropriate connections relative to upland inputs and upland transitions so that, it's a continuum of habitat. It's not, and this goes to scale that was discussed a little bit earlier. You just don't make a little piece of wetland someplace and expect it to function. There's an aspect of size, and in many cases it's a very large size of thousands of acres to create the hydrodynamic conditions within the system to generate the formation of the habitat that you're looking for, as well as having uplands next to it so that with sea level rise the marsh has an opportunity to move up with it, you get the inputs, particularly hooking it up with the riverine inputs that come from upslope so that you have sediment supply coming to this area. One of the problems in the delta is the availability of sediment. It used to be that the delta was clogged with sediment from the mining debris. Mm-hmm. Much of that's been flushed out of the system now. And so now we're a sediment-starved system. So wherever we can connect to the fluvial inputs with these aquatic habitats, that's what we're trying to do. Okay. Does that get?
Yeah, thank you.
Supervisor, did you have a?
Just very briefly, on the last page of the, page two of this report, you talk about, as this would line up with, Delta Vision near-term actions and some of the focuses and so forth, is it the intent then that you're going to pursue some of these in the PSP process?
Well, we would be soliciting projects that were consistent with those objectives.
Okay, because, again, I'm not familiar with all the, certainly the technical aspects of some of these things, but you talk about barrier pile of projects and so forth. I know some of those barrier projects become very controversial.
Barrier projects are not. We're looking at physical habitat restoration,
okay,
as opposed to engineered solutions within the delta.
Okay, because two of these, and I don't know what the numbers refer to. You get the bullet points. I don't know if those were actually out of the Delta Vision.
So they're both out of Delta Vision, and they're also directions not to Fish and Game so much on some of these, but to Department of Water Resources.
Okay.
And some of them were mentioned in the statute. So, for example, the statute told not Fish and Game, but Water Resources
to construct and implement the two-gate fish protection demonstration project by December 1, 2010, evaluate three-mile slough barrier, expeditiously move ahead with other near-term acts identified in the strategic plan, that's Delta Vision, and also the Cabinet Committee's review of it, and then assist in implementing things like, but not limited to, Dutch Slough tidal marsh restoration and Means Island tidal marsh. I mean, the statute is very dense in some of these details, mm-hmm. and but most of them are water resources in those areas, and our listing here is, I think, a combination of both water resources and fish and game responsibilities,
okay.
not just fish and game. Okay.
So in the case there, we're looking primarily at the habitat-related things, and relative to that legislation, we are a funding partner for Dutch Slough. ERP money originally was involved in the acquisition of Dutch Slough. We may or may not be a partner in the Means Landing project.
Does Fish and Game give you approval of your projects and you give approval of Fish and Game's projects? Is that how this works?
Well, Fish and Game approves the projects. Originally, projects went through the CalFed CBDA hierarchy
right.
to get approved, but ultimately the department made the decision about funding something.
Okay.
That answers that point. Just one follow-on then. Are you still pursuing the wildlife-friendly farming assistance
program? We still have projects and still have some funding available for that.
Okay.
Most recently, those have been primarily on a directed action basis.
On a what, Carl?
On a directed action basis. This kind of goes to the agency or a project is specifically identified, either from a past solicitation or something that arises more immediately, and funding is then directed to it after it goes through the evaluation process.
Okay. One last question then. There's been a lot of discussion about subsidence and will continue to be, but with your agricultural practices, have you had any work with farmers on practices? And again, a lot of them will implement best practices anyway because they want their soil to be sustained. But have you had any integration with either your science and or Fish and Game's work to assist farmers in that regard, particularly as you look at the islands? I mean, there's been a lot of reference to subsidence in the islands and so forth, but again, most of those for the good part of them are farmed, and has there been any work in that area?
Well, most of these are targeted at agricultural activities and developing agricultural management plans that would incorporate wildlife enhancements into the normal or improved agricultural practice. So they're not, they're there to look at how you could improve the agricultural land's capacity to support fish and wildlife, as opposed to...
And still make a living farming off of it?
Right, yes.
One of the things this discussion reminds me of is the staff's counted up 41 things we requested yesterday, and somewhere on the list, although I cannot find it right now, was a suggestion about the delta, the collection of islands and areas, the primary and secondary zone, simple land use patterns, land ownership patterns, levels of threat, restoration activities. I mean, we just need to be able to have, as fast as we can get it, a source document or documents to which we can refer when these discussions pop up and just say, what do we know about the islands? Where is it going on? How is it working collectively? It seems to me you should substantially abuse our consultants and tell them to produce that rapidly. Mr. Grindstaff, sir.
I'll be glad to abuse our consultants.
I got it. Okay.
Maybe even the staff sometimes.
Oh, okay. Anyway.
So as to a point relative to lists or what projects have been done, there is a very large database that's maintained for ERP actions, and we can provide data on what projects they are, what they were intended to do, what they did, those types of things, and how much money went into them, going back to the wildlife friendly agriculture. A lot of work was done in the Yolo Bypass with the Yolo Wildlife Area and coming up with strategies for combining rice agriculture with wildlife management and management of the wildlife area. So it's those types of things. Staten Island is an example of wildlife friendly agriculture.
Excuse me, just one follow-on. Have you integrated this in with the Department of Conservation as well as the Food and Ag? And the reason I ask that is that, and this has been kicking around in my mind, the Williamson Act and what that means for protection, but certainly the and of course Department of Conservation oversees that, the whole status of that as it relates to, you know, county interface, but certainly landowner interface, where you can put into best strategies. In some cases, people won't be able to do anything else besides farm it or leave it in wildlife habitat. But that, you know, the Williamson Act, for a lack of, you know, $30 million, is, you know, threatened in this state. And I hear about what we're doing with grants. I mean, talk about the one big conservation approach that helps agriculture and fishing game is that Williamson Act, what it preserves. And I just think we maybe got to have some discussion again. Maybe today's
item 42 on the list, Williamson Act.
But your involvement in that, I think, is important. So,
yeah, Nancy, you've got that right. Okay, all right, Mr. Scullin.
Carl, have the ERP implementing agencies compiled a lessons learned analysis of the program to date?
Well, that's in the end of stage one evaluation, which we need to get out shortly. As I said, it's a we have 700 pages of documents relative to the projects that were done. We worked on an executive summary that turned into 100 plus pages, and we're trying to winnow that down into something that's more digestible for people, and hopefully can make that available here very soon.
Okay. Members, I'd just like to suggest, we know we've got to do an interim plan, and the statute says shall adopt an interim plan, includes recommendations, early actions, projects, and programs under the early actions section of the statute. I think we ought to bring back at an appropriate time both of these packages for review. My gut instinct is we'll probably like almost all the projects, but we ought to try to assure that the departments are working together, so they are both attempting to satisfy the provisions of law, including the co-equal goals, and that the projects are timely. We will undoubtedly tell you to move faster. I just predict that a high level of certainty. And so if you don't object, my suggestion is just to say to Joe, that's what we got to get back. In fact, it kind of transitions pretty well into the next suggestion, which is the structure of a preliminary plan. Anyway, Mr. Wilcox, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good of you to come. Okay. Well, why don't we just go to that, since we're approaching the witching hour of 12 o'clock, where I told you you would be liberated, hopefully. Mr. Grindstaff, you've got your memo under tab number 15. Draft outline of an interim plan. Tell us what you're thinking about. This is not for action, of course. This is conversation.
It is not for action, but okay. Given that this requirement exists to develop an interim plan, and we have a short time to do it, the legislation doesn't give us a specific date, but I think it's reasonable to assume that since we're going to be adopting a Delta plan in January of in January of 2012, we ought to try and get this done this summer or early fall at the latest. It seemed to me that it was really important to begin talking about what should go into the plan and inviting other people to suggest items that should go into the interim plan. And so what I did was actually go to the Delta Vision Strategic Plan, look at that. I used that basic structure as an outline. So item one is legally acknowledged the co-equal goals. That's really more than that. It's probably background and the things leading up to the plan. I followed the structure in the Delta Vision report at the end, I put in developing a project review process because that's something that the legislation calls on us to do, and it seems like that's an appropriate thing to be part of the interim plan. And then there are several things that are part of the legislation in terms of governance, and I put that in Section 8. Then I went back to the legislation and said, okay, are there things that are in the legislation that aren't in the Delta Vision strategic plan? I use the strategic plan.
Hey, gang, this isn't the document we're looking at. Okay, it's called Draft Outline of Interim Plan. Excuse me, what we try to do on the simulcast
right.
is post the document we're looking at on the simulcast so people at the web and the people in the audience who don't have a copy might be able to read it. So okay.
The document we're looking at is in agenda item 15.
Yep.
So I went back to the legislation and I actually had staff do this and then I did it myself. What are the things that are in the legislation that we need to look at? Then I've had unsolicited suggestions from at least one member of the board who said you need to add these things in. I didn't have time to add them in before this got posted, but they certainly need to go in. Several other people have come to me and said the interim plan needs to include this. My goal is to actually take all of those suggestions and find the appropriate place in this plan and insert a line item, and my goal is to abuse the consultants a little bit more.
Good.
And ask them to help us for each of these line items put together a short summary of what the line item is and why it's important, what the problems might be, and my sense is by soliciting people from the audience, people from the webcast, from the community at large, and from the council, we will get a lot of items that need to be in this plan, and next month I hope to bring back a document that has everything that everyone has submitted, and if they've submitted it early enough, I will try and have at least a paragraph about each of those items so that we can actually, as a council, have a discussion about each of those items and their appropriateness for an interim plan.
Okay, Mr. Fiorini, Ms. Gray, Mr. Roos Collins, Mr. Nordhoff, that order.
In other words, everybody.
Well, everybody.
Thank
yes.
you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have reviewed the list that Joe prepared for us, and I approve of the process you went through to come up with these 30 plus items that are listed. I also then went to the interim action plan that the six federal agencies under the leadership of the Federal Leadership Committee have put together.
That's one you mentioned yesterday.
That I mentioned yesterday. They also have an interim plan, and it was interesting that as I overlaid that with your list, Joe, there are 10 items that they have included generally that are not included, so that suggests that there's more items to include. I provided Joe with a list last week that I had put together that breaks down an interim plan into six basic areas: emergency preparedness, water transfer, native fish protection, water quality, conservation, and other. And under those, there are various subpoints, and there's probably about a dozen items on my list that aren't included in yours. I suspect that there are a number of stakeholders that will have input in addition to a compilation of all of those aforementioned items. So I think, Mr. Chairman, what we need to do is to outline very clearly how we want to accept a stakeholder input. I think we need to set a deadline of 10 days prior to our next meeting so it can be incorporated into the board packet that goes out to the council members. And then tee up all of it. It was probably going to have over 100 different items to look at, prioritize, weed through to come up with an interim plan. But I believe that this will be the test of this council as to how well we address an interim plan. And it's going to be something that I think needs to be done in the next 3 or 4 months.
Yeah. Mr. Roos Collins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe and staff, thank you for this excellent draft. I have several comments. First, we need to be clear on what interim means. I understand it to mean things, useful things to do between now and January of 2012. Is that right?
I think that's right. Useful, maybe a little stronger than that.
Okay. Secondly, it is a useful reminder to us and other state agencies of obligations that should be performed on time. I think it's light with respect to what NGOs and local agencies and federal agencies can do. So, Karen, Melinda Terry, if you're watching, Mark, Bob Biaki, if you're watching, I think Randy is right that we need recommendations from NGOs and local agencies as well as federal agencies for consideration. So I join in Randy's request that you take this seriously and give us your best recommendations on whatever deadline we set. And thirdly, Joe, I think this outline is really focused on sort of keeping to task, but it doesn't have enough disruptive force. And if I may offer an editorial view, I really think that this council, in part, is intended to be a disruptive force, to make things work better. And so more of this, less of that, faster, not slower. I'd really like for staff to give some thought to how we could make recommendations to other agencies that might change what they are currently doing in a manner that will contribute to the co-equal goals.
Specifically why I said it's more than just, I think, yes. A compilation of useful ideas.
Yes, yeah. Agreed. And lastly, Mr. Chair, I will just let you know that I'm going to draw the line at air traffic control.
It's an extreme position, Mr. Bruce Collins. Are you sure of that? Okay. And besides, our pilot here might have some questions.
Exactly.
Okay. That's great.
Some of my comments were really incorporated with what Randy and Richard said. But first, let me thank staff for developing the interim plan, draft plan, and the process that you explained. I agree that this is a very important part of the council because I think this will, we can build on this to present the final plan. And so I certainly think that we should receive input from all stakeholders, all perspectives, to make sure that we have all the information to consider when we do come up with the final plan. So this document, this process is extremely important. So I encourage everyone to make sure that input is given so that we have the correct outline when we go forward. Thank you.
Mr. Nordhoff.
A couple of things. One, you know, I think probably everything is there, probably. And you all know I'm a rookie at this. But I've got a little bit of a problem with the organization. I mean, this is just like tumbling down a lot of activities. And when I used to do strategic planning for Pfizer a long time ago, we tried to organize it into the basics of what, why, and how. What are you going to do? Why are you going to do it? And how are you going to get it done? And the how is probably the most important. What are you going to do? When are you going to do it? And who's responsible for it? So, you know, we could work on this a little bit, but come in under different headings. You know, and try to do a what, why, and how for each one, as well as a timeline. And then the other is a question for Chris. Chris, is it possible to not violate any laws of the state and have a telephonic meeting? You know, where we could digest this and instead of meeting just, you know, for a day and a half or 2 days every month, have interim meetings for maybe an hour where we could call in.
Right. In fact, that's in your rules that you just adopted, your procedures for your meetings. Okay. And it is possible so long as we do the proper noticing.
Well, it's not just the proper notice. If members are at locations calling in under the rules and state law,
right. You
must also make that meeting location open so people can observe if they want to. I remember we had the discussion of I'm in the hospital recovering from surgery, but I don't want to miss the meeting, so I telephone in and I was yelling at Mr. Stevens. You mean I got to open my hospital room? And he says, yes.
I did, and you did yell at me. But I think the short answer is, Mr. Nordhoff, we can do that.
That would be terrific.
And that may be a good way to approach it. Supervisor.
An efficient use of time.
Yep. Just to follow on a couple comments, certainly from the standpoint of the outreach, I think it's important that we look at, you know, methodologies that are available to us, and I do think that, you know, whether it's in our meeting place right here or doing something that allows people to you know, get to us a little easier. And one of those, I think if we're going to have one of our meetings in the Delta, I think that would be an important, as we're doing this, before we actually get to adoption of an interim plan, as we go through the next couple of months or a few months on this, is that one of those hearings in the Delta ought to mm-hmm. occur. And I think invite folks and maybe have the focus at that particular point on the interim plan. So depending on where we're at in either gathering information or discussing it, I think that would be very, very important. Also, I would just be remiss if I didn't, and it's pointed out here, but certainly with regards to the Delta Protection Commission and the Conservancy is yet up and going, although I think there's enough folks appointed that they actually have got a quorum to start if they chose to. But I think, again, having those two particular bodies weigh in, and there's documentation, obviously, that's available and some that will be developed, but I wouldn't put those as two important sources of information. And then lastly, not to get into too much detail on this list, but under the build facilities, item 5, I know I've received some correspondence as it relates to, and I think it was the topic on the last item, on the particularly on the Two Gates Fish Protection Demonstration Project and some, I think, change of thinking potentially on the federal participation in that project and so forth. And so I think that as we go through, and it may well apply to any of these, get the status update, have some discussion. Legislatively, maybe been called out for. I respect that, but I know that's a project that has some deep concern with some of my colleagues, but with in other counties, but also folks at different levels. So,
actually, I agree. I put it in specifically because it was in statute, and I think that means we need to address it in the interim plan. Right. Whether we say we don't think that this should proceed on the timetable that was originally envisioned, or we think that it should be done somehow differently, I think we have to address that because it was in the plan. Okay. So that my intent was not to have any value judgments or put any timetables, but just to start compiling the things that need to be in there.
I guess one final comment. It would be nice if at the end of it, because we don't have an unlimited budget, if we could categorize some things that have to be done, things that are nice to be done, and things that are probably non-essential, or categories similar to that.
Mr. Chair, one further thought. Joe, do we have a distribution list for the counties, the reclamation districts, the water districts, the local agencies within the Delta? And if so, could we notify them of this particular task and invite their comments?
I'm sure that we can. I don't see any problem with that. Keith's saying, yes, we have that list. So.
Well, since we're getting reactions, I want to weigh in on this, too. I think Tom Ricks, the prize-winning reporter of, L.A. Times, did two books on Vietnam. I guess the first was Fiasco, and I forget the name of the second. But somewhere in those books is a quote of a general who was trying to figure out what went right and what went wrong in Iraq. And he said, well, you know, we never did ask the question we should, and it kind of goes as follows. What are we trying to do here? What resources do we need to do it? And how do we know whether we've succeeded or failed? And I thought that was just a kind of a telling observation, because as long as I've been involved in politics and public policy, that's the last question that is ever raised, and it's almost never answered. So for me, this interim plan outline is kind of like asking the question in general, how do we explain what it is we've been asked to do and what it is we're proposing we do? And so I almost look at these lists as a table of contents, not recommendations, but it's how we talk about things. That's why I went to the statute. I like starting with co-equal goals. It's now state law. It kind of explains in large part what we are. The other thing I want to mention is the exercise on the interim plan will just structuring it, how we approach issues, the categories, is hopefully also useful for the Delta plan. I'm sure it will not be the same. But it's hard for me to imagine that the structure we adopt, if we do it carefully enough, isn't at least roughly comparable to what we wind up with. Mm-hmm. That's not the recommendations. That's not the choices. Mm-hmm. That's not the priorities. It's just the way you talk about it. So my goal out of this is to try to get us to the position where all the work that's going to come to us in a rush, in no particular order, complaints flowing out of the air on flood control, and then the next thing it's going to be on conservation, I mean, just all over the map, as always, falls into the categories. Nothing falls out unless we choose to have it fall out, but we discuss them in categories. And if we can do that, I think it's very successful. And then the last thing, I think the suggestion that both Don and Brandy made about affirmatively reaching out and saying, you know, whatever it is, 10 days before the meeting's written comment in advance, post all the comments on the web ASAP, let people react to them. Now, I predict that, there will be 100 comments, and they'll be all over the map. I also predict 50% of the comments will reflect pretty much everybody. How you structure that voice, endless voices and ideas, I do not know. By the way, I reserve the right to say you haven't done it well. It's your mistake and not ours, but it's damnably hard to do. It really is hard to do, but I think it'd be immensely useful. Immensely useful. So, that's me. Okay. This is not an action item particularly, but it's a inspirational, whatever it's called. All right. Anyone in the audience like to talk to us? Please come up to the microphone. Wait a minute. The secretary's still here. Wait. Uh-oh. Mr. Secretary.
You know, the measure of how successful we are going into the future will be in the year 2050 is the Delta vibrant, thriving, both environmentally, economically, and as a community. And in looking at that, it was mentioned just a few minutes ago, and through our Ag Vision process as well in our department, that preserving and looking for solutions from the land means making sure we have an agricultural base to work with. And this idea of, and it was mentioned just a few minutes earlier by Supervisor Natoli, that the Williamson Act has been one of the tools in the toolbox for many years that has helped preserve farmland. Clearly, it has budget issues, and I wanted to make sure this panel knows that there's quite a good effort with a lot of different stakeholders to try and look for new solutions for how do we preserve farmland. And in that toolbox, maybe there's a lot of good ways to think about it that we haven't been doing in the past. Maybe there's some other options out there. And I just wanted to be able to talk about the different multiple beneficiaries that come out of good planning, good solution sets. And it was interesting in our Ag Vision process, there's a lot of talk about local food sheds and the regional food production in different areas. Interestingly,
you did a report in early 2008 that itemized kind of programs of assistance to farmers. It was not Delta specific.
That's right.
But it included Delta. And then you got in everybody got in an argument with Peter Glick at the Pacific Institute because he listed a bunch of things. But I read them both. You gave me both of them. Mm-hmm. I read them both, and they kind of came to the same point. I mean, it was really an interesting, well, you stop fussing. I mean, it was not like his usual approach. He actually talked about subsidy programs and voluntary programs as the primary thrust, which had always been the complaint that I understood the agriculture community made most about, other than the fact a non-farmer is telling farmers what to do.
What to grow.
Well, yeah, what to do. Nobody, you know, Americans don't want anybody to do that. Including us, right?
I think the interesting point very quickly was that in the Los Angeles area, they're looking at their regional food shed, and they've created quite an interesting list of policy concepts and recommendations. I believe it's number 3 on their list is preservation of farmland to them is very important. This is down in Los Angeles County in the region that they looked and perceived to be the future site of food for them that would be regionally produced. And I just would then encourage this group again to realize that the Delta is a wonderful and amazing place to produce an awful lot of foodstuffs, and the toolbox that you guys might be able to create through this process would be just yet another chance to get out to the year 2050 with a wonderful solution set from the land. Thanks.
Thank you, sir.
I have a question of the Secretary.
Yes, Randy.
In the federal interim plan, they cite the EQIP program, that stands for Environmental Quality Incentive Program. It's been a very effective program to help facilitate water use efficiency in agriculture. But I'm told that the federal government is considering cutting off the funding for that. Have you heard?
I'm going to hope that the coalition of folks that just see the benefits of that program will be able to step it up and actually go the other way. They're already starting, just in this last week, some of the early discussions and hearings on the 2012 Farm Bill. And we believe very strongly across the country that there's just a growing sense of stakeholder development, if you will, for what a new 21st century farm bill will really look like. And in there, I'll guarantee you, a lot of folks will be focused on conservation benefits, ecosystem benefits, the chance of looking at how, going back to this idea of solutions from the land, we really have to start converging, I guess, our resources towards making sure, again, we can get out to 2050.
So your agency is going to be an advocate for expanding
absolutely,
or at least maintaining the EQIP program.
One thing you might want to do is bring the NRCS Chief Ed Burton.
NRCS.
NRCS. Did I say NRCS?
No, I know, but you're using acronyms. All of us may not know.
The Natural Resource Conservation Service Director Ed Burton up here, and he can describe to you some of the amazingly good projects and funding that they've been able to bring to the state of California during a time of really fiscal tightness. So. And that's would really help inform this board of the need for people to really realize what a great benefit, especially as our state budget will continue to suffer in the years to come, how important the federal budget becomes then for us to make sure that we're not slipping backwards in some of our goals.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
Please.
Mr. Chair, Council Members, Mark Rentz, Association of California Water Agencies. First of all, I do want to, on behalf of Tim Quinn, the Executive Director, express his apologies. He could not be here today, and he considers your actions that you're taking extremely crucial, and he plans on participating and being present a lot in the future. He wanted me to convey one of the reasons he wanted that comment brought forward is just this item right here we consider very important. I think everybody in this room realizes, but we can't emphasize it enough, that we're in an immediate water crisis. We're approaching a very dangerous crossroads that we think that this interim plan that you're working on is very crucial to helping address the short-term needs that we have to have for attaining both the co-equal goals. That being said, Joe, I'm very appreciative of your comments because you took away a lot of the comments and one of the lot of specifics I was going to bring forward, and it will be in an AQUA letter that comes forward to you. But I do want to take one moment on one other aspect, and Hank, you hit it a little bit, and I think it's very critical as you're deliberating on this, is give some real thought to how you're going to prioritize this and how you're going to make decisions on what's thumbs up and what's thumbs down. You're going to get a litany from everybody that's got an interest in this, as you point out, Mr. Chair, of items. And the challenge I see, as I see it, is you're going to be doing some sort of multivariable analysis here, because you're going to have a lot of variables, a lot of which are ideas, concerns coming forward. It's easy to do multivariable analysis from my experience when the items are independent of each other, but a lot of these items are interdependent. If you forego one, what does it mean for the other? If you do these others, what does it mean for that first one? And there's some that you may want to forego for one reason, but if you forego it, it has major implications. And I just wanted to use one example that struck me as I was listening today. I'd heard it before, but I think it's very important. And that's the example of another stressor called predation. I heard your chief scientist say that predation is a very significant factor for the restoration of salmon populations. Somewhere along the line, I think you said, Cliff, of 90% of the salmon in the system are being affected by predation in the San Joaquin. On the other hand, I heard the Fish and Game representative say there's not a lot we can do, or that we understand that we can do, about the invasive species once they're, which are some of them are predators once they're in the system. That is a situation that I think we're going to somehow have to come to reckon with if it's got that significant.
So we should either
impact.
Conclude on all issues there's nothing we can do, or on every issue anyone raises we can satisfy them?
No, what I'm saying is you're going to have to figure out a process for how you take into account risk of not doing something, and how you prioritize those, and there's going to be many variables that come to play. One of them is going to be economically, you may not be able to afford to do it, but can you economically afford not to do it? So that's the only point I was trying to make is I think you're going to have to spend some time also coming up with your prioritization scheme as you start working your way through on a very short time frame on multi-issues. Thank you very much for your
Thank
time.
Thank you very much. Okay, anybody else?
Mr. Chair, Mark, I mean, of course, that is fundamentally right. And if I may, speaking as one member of this council, I would find it most helpful if AQUA and other NGO and local agencies who comment follow that same discipline and prioritize in your recommendations what you think we should do.
Thank you. I think that's a very good suggestion. I will take that back.
And ask Mr. Quinn when we're going to get those two full-time paid staff assigned from AQUA to our project that he promised.
Okay, yeah.
If you would. In writing? No.
Money better than people.
Well, we take it. All right. Thank you very
you
much.
You have to talk to your lawyer on
Thank
that.
You. Thank you.
Phil?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Fiorina?
Thank you. Mark, one of the other things that I would ask for from your submittal as well as everyone else's is the categories or the items that are listed that should be considered for the interim plan ought to also include some idea of how to measure those objectives. I think it's in the legislation, we're asked to include metrics.
Performance measures.
Performance yeah. measurements. And I think it's incumbent upon us as we define the particular project or the particular action that we want to include, that there's a way to measure the objectives. So
when you're talking about measure, are you talking about success?
For example, the predation. It's fine to go after bass and try and reduce the influence of predation on out-migrating salmon. But give us an idea of how you think we ought to measure that so that we know we've achieved success.
I think that's a good suggestion for all of us, and I would definitely
and
carry that
it's
back.
Not just to you. It's yeah. my recommendation mm-hmm. right. that this council ask that of everybody that submits.
And I think ideas. I think that's a good component that can play into your evaluation and prioritization.
And the question, you know, Ms. Fiorini raised a very important point, which is it's not just saying what should be done. It's declaring with certainty if you fail to reach this goal, whatever it is, it's failure. And is there a consequence?
Good.
And everyone usually argues that, yeah, it means you should try again. But we're not in that kind of situation. I'm interested in consequences as well.
Mr. Chair.
Good point.
Just picking up on as well on another of Hank's earlier comments, how is very important. So let's take predation as a for instance. The Bay Delta Conservation Plan has struggled for years, as you know, to try to figure out what to do effectively about predation. We agree on the problem, but it's the solution, the how, that really makes a difference. And so for each recommendation, I hope that you and other commenters make a specific, describe specifically how the recommendation may be implemented effectively against some performance metric that Randy described.
Good. Thank you. That's a very good feedback. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Okay. Members, last piece of business. Anyone else like to speak to us? Okay. Last piece of business. This follow-up list, which with Mr. Natoli's addition to the Williamson Act, now has like 42 items. I skimmed it only. It looks reasonable to me. This will be posted on the web for us to look at also. If you have other ideas or suggestions, I would urge you to get them in to staff as soon as possible. And with our new Delta plan and consultant hiring and so on, it'll be a busy 3.5-week period between now and lead up to the next meeting. Yes, Mr. Grindstaff.
I just want to point out there were several items that were brought up this morning that will be added to the list.
Okay.
And as the chair said, we will post that and be glad to take feedback from any of you and anybody in the public.
Okay.
Could I add to the list?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Just a quick report back from the commission meeting last night. We will be assisting Mr. Grindstaff and his staff in finding locations through the commission's efforts for the meetings in the Delta. The item I wanted to add to the agenda, Mr. Chair, if I could, I mean, to the reports back, it did come up at our commission meeting last night that we are moving full steam on the review of the primary zone. However, we do not have funding available to do that. We have less than 70 days to complete that. And so I indicated that I would report out to the council today that maybe there's a way that we can work with the council's budget to get the commission the funding at least in advance so we can go forward with that effort. We have a consultant that will be coming on board soon. We have funds to execute the contract to start that work by early next month. Less than $100,000 is the number that's been given to me. I know that Secretary Snow has been working to try to get us some funding, minimal amount. And so I guess I just offer that. Maybe you can have some conversation, Joe, and certainly bring it back to this council. But it's a critical piece. If we don't have that primary zone review, I think our interim plan, even advising that's going to be a bit deficient. And so I wanted to bring that forward. And, again, it's not a matter of when, if we'll get the money. I think it's when. And it's hampering our ability right now to go forward. So I wanted to bring that forward.
Okay.
Thanks.
Anything else? Mr. Grindstaff, Ms. Steele. Anyway, staff?
Motion to adjourn.
No motion is needed to adjourn, let me assure you. We are adjourned. We'll see you at the next meeting. Thank you very much. And ideas, comments suggested in the interim would be much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Bill. Good job. Good luck to you on your
head. Yeah. Sorry.